Monday Night Raw, we are set for Divas Musical Chairs analysis on this.
I mean, we've done some dumb things on Raw. This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Next thing you know, Andy Kaufman will show back up. The people are chanting for Jerry. I don't blame them. I'm chanting for commercial.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 302 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Survivor Series Sunday, November 24th, 2013. I want you to know it took me three tries to say that because I kept saying September. So I'm way behind here. No, it's November 24th, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. It is Survivor Series tonight on pay-per-view. This used to be a time where I would look forward to the pay-per-view. Survivor Series has been a tradition since 1987. It's the second longest running big event, second longest running pay-per-view in WWE, and it's the one they treat the most like shit. And unfortunately, this year is no exception. So we'll have some predictions we'll run through really quick here in a moment. But first, I just want to mention that if you want to listen to the Sound Off, you can do so each and every week, multiple ways. TheSolidMonster.com is our official website. You can stream the show. You can direct download the show there. Of course, there's also Stitcher, Radio On Demand. We are climbing the Stitcher sports charts each and every week. So even if you listen to the show already or you heard part of the show, just by streaming the show in Stitcher, either on the web or through the free mobile app that they have, you're helping the Sound Off. So please stream us on Stitcher and leave us some feedback there. And of course, there's iTunes. We have a free app in the Google Play Store for those people with Android devices. And you can make a PayPal donation to show your support of the show. Go to thesolidmonster.com. You'll find a little PayPal donate box there. I've had some people email me asking me why there's no recurring subscription option. And I would love to do that, but it just has to do with the way I have it all set up. I just am not able to do that right now. So if you want to contribute on an ongoing basis, I'm certainly not against that. I encourage that even. But if you want to make a donation, even just a one-time donation, that's where you can make that happen. Before we get into anything else here, got to mention some sad news this week. The death of Maurice Mad Dog Vachon, who passed away a few days ago, 84 years old. And one of the greatest heels of all time, hence the name Mad Dog. I think the story about the name Mad Dog goes back to, and they talked about this actually in the Associated Press article that ran at a whole bunch of places. It was a match in 1962 where he was waiting for his opponent to come to the ring, and he got very impatient, and he started attacking people, and he attacked a police officer and a referee, something that he would claim years later was actually a shoot, which that, you know, he got suspended for and he got fined some money for. I think that's just the old school wrestler and him wanting people to believe that it was a shoot. But anyway, that's kind of the origins of the Mad Dog name. He wrestled as part of a tag team with his brother, Paul the Butcher Vachon, who is still alive. In fact, one of our listeners, Corey, wrote in a few days ago when the news broke. He learned of Mad Dog's passing through Paul. He had befriended the Butcher and happened to see him. I think he said it was in a mall or something a few days ago, and Paul was the one to break the news to him that his brother had died that morning. So that's kind of a jarring moment. I think if you're in Corey's shoes, that was quite the story to share. But, you know, Mad Dog went on to be a world heavyweight champion in the AWA multiple times. I think five times total he held that title. He beat Vern Gagne, the legendary Vern Gagne, multiple times. And after his stint in the AWA, he jumped over to the World Wrestling Federation. He turned babyface. I don't know if he was ever a heel in WWF, but I mean, it's not like he had a big run there anyway. He was there mostly just wrestling on, you know, house shows and such. He never really had a serious run in the company. He retired from wrestling in 1986, and the year after that, he was the victim of a hit and run accident while he was out jogging that required his right leg below the knee to be amputated. And I think a lot of newer in that if you grew up in the 90s, would probably remember that one In Your House pay-per-view, the one where Diesel had that match with Shawn Michaels, the no-holds-barred match. That was actually Kevin Nash's final pay-per-view, may have been his final TV match in the company, and maybe the best match he ever had, thanks in large part to his buddy Shawn Michaels. It was during that match at the Good Friends Better Enemies pay-per-view where Diesel, Mad Dog was a special guest, he was in the front row, and Diesel walks over to Mad Dog, he grabs his leg, and he rips his leg off. Talk about a heel thing to do. He ripped the guy's leg off, and he used it to beat another wrestler. Actually, it was Shawn Michaels who got hold of the leg and used it as a weapon on Nash. So I think a lot of people probably remember Mad Dog more for that one angle in 1996 than they do for a lot of the stuff he did over the body of his career. That wasn't the only time that Mad Dog had his leg ripped off in an angle on WWF television. They honored him and the Crusher in Milwaukee with a ceremony in the ring back at the Over the Edge pay-per-view in 1998 when Jerry Lawler ran in. He grabbed Mad Dog's leg, he took it off, and he tried using it as a weapon on the Crusher. And much like the first angle, the Crusher ended up getting the leg and using it on Lawler. And you felt bad, too, because I went back after I heard the news that he had died. I went back and I watched the In Your House thing and I watched the Over the Edge thing, the ceremony, which I had almost forgotten about. And just watching Mad Dog come out, it was very sad because you could tell ever since the accident, he has not been able to move around well at all. He had two ladies. I mean, he was an older man anyway at that point. But that accident, by all accounts, was something that affected him until the day he died. He was in a lot of pain. He wasn't very mobile. So, it took him a long time to get him down to the ring, into the ring. He was moving very gingerly. And I felt bad, when Lawler ripped the leg off, you could tell, he kind of fell. And I didn't know if, Lawler was being too rough with the guy or what the deal was. So it's kind of a shame to see that he ended up like that. But 84 years old, he lived a long life. He was the uncle of Luna Vachon, who died back in 2010. So yeah, Mad Dog, who was inducted actually that same year into the WWE Hall of Fame back in 2010. Very deserving, certainly a Hall of Famer, a legend. Never had a meaningful run in WWE, but certainly did elsewhere. And he will be remembered. And speaking of legends that were in the news this week, the Dynamite Kid, Tom Billington, apparently suffered a stroke at some point this past week. WWE.com had a story up yesterday about it, that he had suffered a stroke. And some reports indicate that it may have been multiple strokes. I don't know what the deal is with Dynamite. Apparently he's in rough shape. So I guess when we hear more, we'll know what the state of the Dynamite Kid is. He's basically been banished over in the UK ever since the early 90s. I mean, the story as I remember it is, he treated his ex-wife like shit. There was even the story that he would hold like a shotgun to her, chin and stuff like that. Dynamite Kid will not go down as one of the best human beings on the face of the earth. He may go down as one of the best wrestlers, but that doesn't make you a good person. And by all accounts, he was not a very good person. And I think the story is that his wife bought him a one-way plane ticket and basically gave him the option to, get the hell out of Dodge, or I don't know what the other option was. She would divorce him or call the cops or whatever. I don't know. But he took her up on it. He flew out there, and I don't know that he's ever been back. I think he's pretty much been out there ever since, and he's been confined to a wheelchair for a number of years. I know that. So hopefully we'll have an update on his condition soon enough. Let's talk about Survivor Series, pay-per-view tonight from Boston, Massachusetts. Just awful build-up to this show. I mean, is there really anybody out there who's truly, honestly looking forward to Survivor Series? I mean, I'm sure there's younger fans who don't know of the history of the pay-per-view, but you don't have to be a wrestling fan for 15 or 20 years. You can be a wrestling fan for 6 months. I think they've done a shit job of promoting this show, and it's a shame. It's really a shame because it doesn't have to be that way. We've got Randy Orton and Big Show in the main event for the WWE Championship. I've seen these rumors online that, the Big Show is going to join the Authority. They might even do a double turn with him and Orton, which I think would be dumb. Any sort of major swerve like that they might pull to me is just not what they need to be doing. We had a major swerve at SummerSlam, and I thought it was great because it had been a while since we had something like that, and it kind of made sense. Orton was not really in the main event mix for a number of years. He was long overdue, in his mind, right, for a world title reign. And so he partnered with Triple H. They did what they had to do to get the belt off Bryan, and it turned Orton heel. It turned Triple H heel. I thought it was very well done. And I don't need to start seeing them do, swerves every other month, especially the way that we've seen the Big Show angle unfold. I know I've made comments before, you know, he was being very buddy-buddy with Daniel Bryan to the point where I thought Big Show was going to do the turn like a month or two ago, and they didn't do it. And now there's no interaction at all between Big Show and Bryan. To just turn Big Show heel after all the shit they put him through would make absolutely no sense. I figure there's going to be, the screw job, I think, is what most people probably expect. Maybe Kane is involved, maybe he isn't. Triple H on Raw Monday night said there's going to be no interference, there's going to be no Shield. You're going to go in there and prove that you can do this on your own. And I don't buy that for a second. I'm sure that something will happen. But I can't see Big Show winning the championship. I mean, anything's possible, but Big Show does not need to be WWE champion right now. So my pick is Randy Orton. He retains the title. John Cena, Alberto Del Rio for the World Heavyweight Championship rematch from Hell in a Cell, where Cena beat Del Rio quite decisively to the point where I know the champion gets a rematch. That's been the provision now for a number of years, but there really is no reason for this match to be happening. You know, Cena beat the guy basically with one arm, the way they built up that arm injury, just like he beat Sandow with one arm. There's no drama involved here, and Alberto Del Rio is just boring. He's not a bad wrestler, but I just am bored by him right now. They've stripped him of the cars. They stripped him of Ricardo. All of those things kind of gave some personality to his character. They made him unique. He doesn't have any of that anymore. And on Raw Monday night, Del Rio brought up the fact that they're in Boston, Cena's hometown. His family's going to be there. Cena said his brothers will be there, maybe his dad, all these people. You know, if they're in the front row, I could see maybe them coming into play. Del Rio goes after them. You know, John Cena's dad has been physically involved before. If you go back a number of years, Randy Orton punt kicked him in the head once. And again, Cena's father is actually a personality in wrestling himself up in the New England area. Johnny Fabulous, I think his name is. But I could see that, and that could be kind of cool. But I still don't think the outcome of this match is in any real doubt. My pick is John Cena. I get the sense they want him to have a somewhat lengthy run, maybe even hold the title through WrestleMania. I certainly don't see him losing it right back to Del Rio, you know, 3 weeks after he beat him for the belt. Del Rio, to me, is a dead duck. John Cena is my pick. CM Punk and Daniel Bryan against Luke Harper and Eric Rowan of the Wyatt family. They're trying to give the Wyatt some rub. That's all well and good, but putting these four guys in a regular tag team match at Survivor Series is a letdown. It's just not the match that I think most people wanted to see. The match most people wanted to see, we got that already. So it's just a normal tag team match. I figure Harper and Rowan go over. Bray Wyatt, I'm sure, will be at ringside. He may factor into that. They can lose. Punk and Bryan can lose and not lose anything from the loss. But Harper and Rowan with a big win over Punk and Bryan could be a big deal for them. So unless they're just going to have Punk, you know, knee one of them in the face and pin him, I don't really see what that accomplishes. I think this could be a really big win for the Wyatts, so I'm going to go with Harper and Rowan getting the victory here. We have the Rhodes brothers, Cody and Goldust, teaming up with the Usos and Rey Mysterio, who made his return to Raw Monday night. They're taking on The Shield and the Real Americans in a match that kind of feels a little thrown together, but should still be a good match, may even be one of the best matches on the card, given the talent involved. I'm going to go with the baby faces here. I think the Rhodes, Usos, and Mysterio get the win. The Shield, it's not like they've been protecting those guys much. The Shield's been losing an awful lot lately. There's still rumors of a pending breakup, which I'm still hopeful they will hold off on that until sometime next year. Make me very sad to see the Shield break up anytime soon. So, I'm going to go with the baby faces in this match. We have AJ Lee, Tamina, Alicia Fox, Summer Rae, Oksana, Caitlyn, and Rosa Mendez against Team Total Divas, the Bellas, the Funkadactyls, Natalya, Eva Marie, and JoJo in a 7-on-7 elimination match that I hope and expect will be over within 5 minutes. There are some talented women in this match. You know, I have no problem with AJ. I think Summer Rae is actually quite good already, and I think she's only going to get better. Alicia Fox isn't, you know, terrible. Everybody else on that team, though, I could do without. Natalia's in there. I mean, there could be some good action. I just picture this as being your typical big divas match where they just eliminate a whole bunch of women as quickly as possible. So a bunch of quick pinfalls, maybe some submissions, and it maybe breaks down into a really, really bad brawl with a bunch of women who don't know how to wrestle. And that's really all there is to it. They put this thing together to help promote the show. And for that reason, I would think that Team Total Divas gets the win, because why would you be promoting a reality show with a bunch of losers? So Team Total Divas is my pick. Kofi Kingston against The Miz. A heel Miz. We'll get to all that when I get to the Raw review. I don't want to dive into it now. That is the Survivor Series kickoff match. And being that The Miz is now fresh off a heel turn, I don't see how he can lose this match. If he loses this match, then all hope is lost. You turn the guy heel, you gave people hope, right? That finally they're going to do something different with this guy. He's playing the role he should have been playing all along. And you're going to have him lose to Kofi Kingston, the perennial loser on the WWE roster? I don't think so. So Miz is my pick here. There is one match I forgot. They added Curtis Axel and Big E Langston for the Intercontinental title. Big E just won the belt. He ain't losing it. Big E's my pick. They've got Bret Hart, Mick Foley, and Booker T on the Survivor Series expert panel. They'll be doing analysis of the pay-per-view during the pre-show and during the pay-per-view, I would guess. Bret Hart, you know, when I saw Bret Hart's name, the first thing that crossed my mind was just, let it go. Survivor Series, Bret Hart, I guess the two are synonymous now for the rest of time, but just let it go. What does Bret really have to add to this panel anyway? Bret's probably not even paying attention to most of the shit that's going on. If anything, he probably looks at this and is he's disgusted by how far Survivor Series has fallen since the Montreal days. So yeah, those are your legends for the analyst panel. A very missable pay-per-view. I don't see any reason to spend $50 on this show. It could turn out to be a sleeper show with a bunch of great matches. To me, though, they haven't earned your $50. When it's time to pay money for a pay-per-view, you should at least think to yourself, okay, they've done something that justifies me spending $50 or more of my money on their pay-per-view. They've done nothing. They've done nothing. So, a very missable show, a very disappointing build to Survivor Series this year. There's just nothing else really to say about it. And if you do order the pay-per-view after complaining about the last three, you get what you deserve. Because ever since SummerSlam, it's been all downhill. Night of Champions was a disappointing show. Battleground was a disappointing show. Hell in a Cell, I thought overall, was a disappointing show. After three times, you would hope that people learn their lesson. And if there's one way to send a message to WWE, if you're not enamored with their booking and the way they promote things, is just not to give them your money. Raw Monday Night was a special country-themed edition. It was Raw Country, they called it. From Nashville, Tennessee, the go-home show to Survivor Series. And the main event that we got on Raw Monday night was Survivor Series. So if you watch that show on Monday night, you don't really have a reason to order the pay-per-view tonight. You got the 12-man tag that you probably wanted to see. CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, the Rhodes Brothers, and the Usos against the Shield and the Wyatt family. And I thought it was a great match. I loved it. I love those big tag matches like that. I love seeing the Shield and the Wyatts working together, just like I'll probably love it later on when they inevitably clash and probably wrestle each other. I thought this match, it started slow, it built, you know, it was built like a Survivor Series match, only without the eliminations. I think that was probably the one thing that was really missing. I would have loved to have seen this as an elimination style match, especially given the outcome that we had. Yeah, the outcome was the babyfaces winning. So as if it wasn't bad enough that they gave you Survivor Series for free on Raw 6 days before the pay-per-view, the babyfaces went over. You know, it's like the good guys won. So you don't really even have a reason to go back and, let's say, watch it again. Not that you would anyway, because they split most of those guys up into different matches at the pay-per-view. But they just gave it to you. They gave it to you for free on television on Monday night. Monday night, I wasn't complaining. I watched it. I loved the match. But now that Survivor Series is here, what incentive is there for me to pay money when I've already seen the match I wanted to see? And I see these reports online that, well, the reason they booked this match on free television is because they're so anxious to get as much money in TV rights fees. Because, you know, the contracts for Raw and SmackDown, they're coming due, I think, within the next year. And WWE thinks they could triple, maybe even quadruple, the amount of money they get from whether it's USA Network or whatever network is willing to pay for their content. And that's all well and good. That still is no excuse for giving this match away for free. I mean, give me a break. The 12-man tag is given away on Monday night. What does that have to do with rights fees? You could have given people a completely different 12-man tag involving some of those guys, save the real match for the pay-per-view. I mean, what an idiot I am, right? I thought that you save your best matches that people really want to see for the pay-per-view 6 days later. You could have given people a gigantic preview of Survivor Series by giving them a fun 10-man tag, 12-man tag main event that goes 20, 30 minutes. Didn't have to be this match, so that's not a valid excuse. But look, why am I even complaining? We got Survivor Series for free. on Monday night. So, you know what? Worst things have happened before. The match itself, I thought, was really, really good. Goldust aside, I made this comment in the live tweeting. I looked at everybody in that match, and I see the future of this company. The Shield, the Wyatts, Punk and Bryan, I guess, to a lesser degree, because they're already, you know, mid-30s, and they've been around for a while. Although Bryan, I think, I could see Bryan as somebody who, if he stays healthy, can still be on top or near the top, working with a lot of these newer guys for the next 5 to 10 years. Punk, maybe not so much. He's always, you know, teasing he may, you know, hang up the boots, and I know Punk is all beat up. But again, you look at Cody, you look at the Wyatts and the Shield and the Usos. You know, I think the Usos also at some point, they've got to win the tag team titles. I think that they deserve a shot to run with the belts. I see the future of this company. And when you look at that, the future looks bright. Through all the shit that we may have now and all this crap with the Authority and everything else, there is a lot of hope in the future with these guys and some of the guys they have down in NXT. So I'm watching this match Monday, and I see the future. So main event went 24 minutes, which actually made it longer than all of the matches on Monday Night Raw last year, believe it or not. The only match longer this year was the John Cena-CM Punk match in February, the match with the pile driver. The babyfaces got jumped by the heels when the match was over. That's when Rey Mysterio came out to do his run-in and make the save. Mysterio did not look good running down to the ring. You could tell he was moving slower, and he was moving in such a way that kind of screamed, yeah, my knee's not 100% yet. He came in, he did his signature spots, he did the 619, I think he did a double 619, and all the baby faces celebrated, everyone went home happy. A few other random notes from the show on Monday night. The opening segment had a weird moment where Randy Orton confronted Triple H, because Triple H and Stephanie were back. They were back from vacation, unfortunately. And Orton was very angry, he was very upset about being chokeslammed by the Big Show the week before through the announce table. So he's face-to-face with Triple H, nose-to-nose, and in a nose-to-nose battle, Triple H will always win. And there's this really awkward moment where Triple H gets angry and he says to Orton, you know, who the hell do you think you're talking to? And Orton responds by saying, you know, the WWE champion in the face of the company. And I'm listening to this and I'm going, huh? What? And either what happened is Triple H fucked up and his line was supposed to be, who the hell do you think you are? Or Randy Orton messed up. But the reason I mention this, I mean, mistakes happen. It's not a big deal. But this is what happens when everything is overscripted to death. These guys go out there. They've got their lines that they got to get in, right? So Randy Orton, who's not a strong promo guy to begin with, he has his moments, but largely, I don't look at Randy Orton and say, wow, this guy's one of the better promo guys in WWE. He's not. So he goes out there. I mean, after all, Randy Orton's the same guy who was out there in front of the audience. I think it was maybe the night after WrestleMania, the show that I was at. He's in the ring with Sheamus. He forgets his line. And he has to walk over to Sheamus and go, what's my line? I mean, this is what happens. When you have to memorize lines, and you can't just go out there with some idea of what you're supposed to talk about and just wing it and just go for it. We end up with very weird moments like that. And that's not a good thing. That's one of the things I think that sucks about wrestling these days is how overscripted it is. They had Randy Orton in a, I don't even know if you can call it a match, with Brad Maddox. It was more like a destruction. Brad Maddox took quite the beating from Randy Orton here. And it's kind of funny. I just got done talking about what a mediocre promo Randy Orton is. When on Monday night, after that awkward moment, he actually showed some very impressive mic skills, physically, literally. He bashed Brad Maddox over and over and over again in the head with a microphone, and it made a really, really cool noise. So that was a cool moment. Not so much for Maddox, though. We had Big E Langston and Curtis Axel for the Intercontinental Championship. Big E has new remix theme music, which, as I tweeted, pretty much a surefire sign he was winning the championship, and that's exactly what happened. Big E Langston, the new Intercontinental Champion. I say good for Big E. You know, I don't get some of the hate that I see for Big E Langston out there. I don't look at Big E as just some big guy who can't work. He's a big guy. He's got this explosiveness about him. He's very quick on his feet. As a wrestler, he's fine. He's not great. He's not poor. He's a good enough wrestler where all of these other attributes and all these other traits are enough, I think, to where he could be a pretty high-level star, and I think winning the Intercontinental title is the one thing about it that concerns me. So this is 2013 in WWE. In 2013, when you win the U.S. title or you win the Intercontinental title, people worry. They start to worry about you, like, uh-oh, is this the beginning of the end? Because that's how they book these titles. It's like everybody who holds them, it's like poison. I hope that doesn't happen to Big E Langston. I don't see Big E Langston making the title mean anything. I don't think there's anybody on the roster right now who can make that title mean anything. I just hope it's a stepping stone for him to bigger things, and they let him show off some more of his personality. I still don't think they give him enough time, you know, on the mic and in front of the camera, you know, backstage and stuff like that, to show off his real personality. We saw more of that in NXT, not just with the five-count gimmick. I remember watching a contract signing when this would have been right before he lost the NXT title to Bo Dallas. And Bo Dallas is another example, and I'm going to get to that in the NXT review, of a guy who at one time was painful to watch. I mean, Bo Dallas was not a very exciting wrestler, and on the microphone, it made the hair on the back of your neck stand up. He was so bad. You felt bad for the guy. And there was a contract signing segment with him and Big E where, and part of it may have been just Bo was so bad, that when Big E got on the mic, and I remember this because Jim Ross was actually emceeing the contract signing, I thought Langston was awesome. He was full of charisma, and I just thought to myself, why can't he show more of that on Raw? Why am I only seeing this on NXT? And I think slowly we're going to start to see a little bit more of that. So again, I don't get the hate for Big E. I think people who, you know, just look at the guy and think he sucks, or they don't, you know, he's big, and so that's, you know, the only redeeming thing about him. I think those people are very short-sighted, and I think those people are going to be eating their words many months from now. So congratulations to Big E. I'm happy for the guy. We also on this show had one of the worst segments in the history of Monday Night Raw, which covers a lot of ground. There's been a lot of really bad shit on this show over the years. We had Divas Musical Chairs. Musical Chairs is an interesting one because they did a Divas Musical Chairs once before on NXT in 2010. When NXT was an actual show on, I guess it would have been Sci-Fi or whatever. I vaguely remember the segment, but I know they did one with the Divas before. The musical chairs that everybody remembers from Raw was like a decade ago, and it was awesome because it was so unique. It was something you never saw before. It sounded so stupid, but the people that were involved, Chris Jericho, Ric Flair, they had really talented guys involved, and they made that work. That was a very entertaining... Ric Flair made that whole segment. So I actually, when I first heard Divas Musical Chairs, my first inclination was to go, all right, let's see how they do this, because the last one I remember was actually pretty entertaining. This was not entertaining in any way, shape, or form. And you heard the audio at the beginning of the show where, even on commentary, JBL is basically... I mean, I don't know if this was Vince in his ear or what the deal was. He was ripping left and right on this segment. He was saying, people, you know, we should just go to a commercial. A commercial would be better than this. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. And I don't know why they book these segments. It's like they book them for their own amusement. You hear the announcers laughing. This is the final Raw before Survivor Series. This is what I'm talking about. They've done such a piss-poor job of promoting this pay-per-view. Somebody actually thought that this segment would be a good way to set up and to promote the Divas match for their fourth biggest pay-per-view of the year. Somebody actually thought that it would be a good way to A, promote the reality show, and B, promote Survivor Series. Fail. And it went longer than most Divas matches do. It went about 2 minutes. I did a Divas Musical Chair stopwatch, the first and hopefully the last one I ever have to do. Big Show and Ryback had a match on this show, and to think that at one point, the rumors were that Big Show and Ryback would have a match at this year's WrestleMania, with the big spot being Ryback getting Big Show up on his shoulders for Shell Shock. It was impressive when Ryback did it to Mark Henry, but I think if the visual of Ryback lifting Big Show up on his shoulders at WrestleMania in front of 75,000 people would have been a much more lasting memory. And instead, we actually had Ryback lift up the Big Show in this match on Raw and give him the shell shock. And people reacted to it. You think at some point people start to get desensitized. We've seen a lot of feats of strength on television. We see Antonio Cesaro swinging the Great Khali. We've seen Ryback pick up a bunch of big guys up on his shoulders for shell shock. People still reacted big to it. And he drops him, and he goes for the pin, and Big Show kicks out. which again tells me that Ryback is dead, because if they had any plans for Ryback at all, that's the sort of thing you save. You know what I mean? You don't just blow it off in some random Raw match. I thought that was kind of odd. Not that I expected Ryback to win. Big Show's the one challenging for the title. I thought this match did not do the Big Show any favors. I thought it didn't do Survivor Series any favors. I thought the Big Show looked terrible in this match. He looked blown up. And there were various points during the match he actually had to tell, if you listened, at one point he said to Ryback, slow down. I guess Ryback was moving too fast for the Big Show. And he was out of breath and moving very, very slowly. I'm not sure if he's still hurt, if he has a leg injury or what the deal is. This match did nothing to change my mind about what a mistake that main event is on the pay-per-view tonight. I thought this was just really, really bad. Big Show, after the shell shock, just got up, punched him in the face, knocked him out, got the pin. Speaking of Ryback, there's talk that he may be on WWE's shit list this week. And judging by the way he's been booked, I'd say he's been on their shit list for most of this year. But supposedly any new, I guess, heat on him may be from what he did with those Goldberg spots. I think I mentioned that last week. The spear and the jackhammer, he used it on SmackDown a couple of weeks ago. I think it was in a match against John Cena. And apparently he did not get permission to use those spots. So it's not a case where they're having him mimic Goldberg's moves as a sign that Goldberg has agreed to come in and wrestle him at WrestleMania. That's not the case. I guess he just went and did it, and he got in trouble for it. And again, I think that sucks, because you should be able to have the freedom to go out there and improvise and do stuff like that. But everything is so freaking choreographed these days. They're so strict. You have no creative freedom, it seems like. It certainly shows on TV that they're very restricted in what they can and can't do. We had a tag team match, Kofi Kingston and The Miz against The Real Americans. I give them a lot of credit for this. You know, it's funny, The Miz's potential heel turn's been in the news a lot of late. He was playing the role of heel in matches against Kofi on the European tour. But I still didn't see it coming, and he pulled a Sid. He did the spot where Kofi's reaching for the tag, and Miz is kind of faking that, oh yeah, you know, go ahead and tag me. And then he just hops down off the apron, and people start booing him, and it's about time. God knows I've been talking about The Miz and what a mistake it's been to keep him as a babyface, and how he should have been turned back heel months and months ago. Because the guy's career has hit the skids ever since. They've just absolutely destroyed whatever credibility he may have had as a babyface. They've jobbed him out, and the best thing for him is to turn him heel. This is the right role for him. I do have to say, though, it was kind of odd to see them recycle the same type of heel turn with The Miz that we just saw on NXT about a week or two ago with Charlotte and Bayley. I know a lot of people probably don't watch NXT, so they may have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about. But Ric Flair's daughter, who's down in developmental and has been a babyface ever since she debuted about 2 months ago, whatever it was in a tag match to open up NXT a couple of weeks ago with another babyface named Bayley, and they were up against Summer Rae and Sasha Banks, and when Bayley went for the tag, Charlotte reached out and smacked her across the face. And that caught me off guard, too. I didn't see that one coming either. And so that was the Charlotte heel turn, and they basically did the same exact angle here on Raw with The Miz. But I'll take it, because The Miz before was just a waste of space on the roster. They weren't doing anything with him. And now maybe that'll be the turning point, maybe, for The Miz in his career. I guess we'll find out. He'll be wrestling Kofi at the pay-per-view on the pre-show tonight. They did a deal where Vicky Guerrero had to wrestle AJ Lee. Vicky and Brad Maddox were both being punished for their indiscretions last week in the absence of Triple H and Stephanie. So AJ beat Vicky. Diva's stopwatch had this at 1:28. They were clearly playing off the very real situation with AJ Lee overseas, where she passed out from dehydration on the European tour. I'll get into this more later during the history segment, but this was the anniversary this week of Shawn Michaels collapsing on Raw during a match against Owen Hart. It was one of the more memorable angles in WWE history. That was an angle. But if it were real, I doubt very seriously they would have poked fun at Shawn Michaels the way they poked fun at AJ Lee on TV this week. Just goes to show you the double standard they have. R-Truth debuted his new tag team partner, Xavier Woods, who was actually R-Truth's tag team partner as Consequences Creed back in TNA during that whole Pac-Man Jones fiasco, when Pac-Man Jones was a tag team champion even though he couldn't wrestle. So they brought in Consequences Creed to basically be his surrogate in a tag team with Ron Killings, as he was back then. So now they're a tag team on Raw. I've seen a lot of Xavier Woods on NXT. This is one of the benefits of watching the show. When these guys debut, I'm at least already familiar with most of them. I'm a fan of his work. I like him as a wrestler. I can't say I'm a huge fan of his character. I don't see him going above a certain level with it. But they love the fact that he's got a PhD or he's taken his master. I forgot. But anyway, he's in school and he's one of these guys they can parade out there in front of the press and say, hey, look at this guy. Isn't this impressive? Just like with Otunga. They don't even put Otunga on TV anymore. You know, they love the fact that when Otunga goes out and people want comments from him about a court case, you know, they can showcase the fact that, hey, this guy's one of our wrestlers, and look at this guy. He studied at Harvard. He's a lawyer. See, we don't have dummies on our roster. We have a lot of very bright people on our roster, and they do. And Xavier Woods is one of them, and that's what they like about him. I don't know that we'd see him on TV, actually, if it wasn't for that, which is a shame because he deserves a shot. Remember when Michael Cole mentioned on commentary a few weeks ago that this guy, Xavier Woods, down in NXT, had started an online petition to help Big Show get his job back? Yeah. Well, neither does WWE, apparently, because if they mentioned it here, I must have missed it. Even if they did mention it, it's not like it played into anything or it has anything to do at all with that storyline. So they must have changed whatever their original idea was for the guy. Which is not shocking, since they've been doing that a lot of late, changing their minds. I just thought that was kind of odd, that they actually went out of their way to mention this guy by name on Raw only a few weeks ago, and the Big Show storyline has progressed. I mean, he's already got his job back. That storyline has progressed. He made his debut on TV this week, and not one mention of it. There's no connection at all between him and the Big Show storyline. They just change their minds all the time. Florida Georgia Line performed live. Their hit song, or so they say, it's a hit. They must be a big deal. I see these commercials for I think it's the American Music Awards tonight on TV, and they're one of the featured performers with all these other big names, and so I guess they're kind of a big deal. It didn't make this segment any more entertaining. It was fine. It was kind of boring. I would imagine these things are much more fun live. Like when I go to WrestleMania, they had Sean Diddy Combs, okay, performing at WrestleMania this year in New Jersey. And I actually enjoyed that a lot. That was actually one of the highlights of the show to me, because I knew a lot of the songs that he was performing. I mean, one of them went back to when I was still in high school, which kind of dates me. But I enjoyed it. I think being there live, that kind of thing could be fun. I mean, some people may disagree with me. You know, when Flo Rida performed The Rock's for The Rock's entrance at WrestleMania last year in Miami, I thought that was great. I enjoyed that. But watching on TV, it's fucking boring. And that's what this was. And all I could think of the whole time as I'm watching this was how badly I wanted for Brock Lesnar's music to hit and just have him come out and destroy everybody on that stage. In fact, I think that would be a great gimmick for Brock Lesnar. We don't get to see Brock that often. But when Brock's music hits, it sends fear into the hearts of many men. And women, too, I'm sure. I mean, Brock could have come out and saved us from that horrendous Divas Musical Chair segment. I think that would have been a quick and easy way to get those women out of the ring. I endorse this idea. Brock Lesnar, the Raw segment killer. Whenever there's bad TV, just send Brock out there and he'll take care of it for us. I hope we don't need Brock this Monday, though. I'm going to be live tweeting the show from the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. I will be at Raw tomorrow night. They aired a localized ad on this show this past Monday, hyping two dark match main events for Raw this week, both of which are just rematches of the two title matches at the pay-per-view. And we know that Michael Strahan of New York Giants fame will be the guest host. Again, with this guest host nonsense. I just hope they don't start doing it every week. They want to do it every now and then just to get a big name on the show. Fine. We don't need the revolving door of guest hosts on TV every single week. So that's all they've announced so far for Raw this week. But like I said, I'll be there live. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I'll be live tweeting from the Nassau Coliseum, which has notoriously had some of the worst crowds. I'm just putting everybody on notice right now. I would not expect a hot crowd for Raw Monday night. I'd actually be downright shocked if the Long Island faithful came out and were loud and boisterous for the entire show. So just putting everybody on notice. In fact, I was at a Raw taping one time back when Paul Heyman was still doing commentary with Jim Ross, and they went to a commercial break. I'll never forget it. I think I've told the story before. Heyman, and maybe somebody in the back told him to do it. They must have. Maybe Vince was pissed. But the crowd was pretty bad, and Heyman, during the commercial break, grabs a microphone, and I think he may have walked up onto the ring steps or something, and he's just looking out at the crowd, and in so many words, he basically said, we were one of the worst crowds he's ever performed in front of, ever. And all I could think sitting there was, he's right. There were people in the arena just shaking their heads like, yeah, you're right. That sounds about right. Hopefully they'll give us something to cheer for. Speaking of things to cheer for, I love the hell out of NXT this week. I thought it was easily the best of the three shows. Impact was good, but not great. Raw sucked, aside from the main event. But after a couple of ho-hum weeks, NXT, I felt, shot back with an hour that just blew by. And the best part? No Raw rebound.
Yeah, bitch! Magnets! Oh!
I don't even know what sense that made. I just wanted to use that clip. Bo Dallas was back from his world tour. I came to the realization on this show that I don't ever want Bo Dallas to lose the NXT championship. He's created this character that he's almost like a parody of John Cena. You know, Cena does all the charity stuff. He's a kid-friendly guy, the big, wholesome babyface who will pretend to be thug every now and then when he wants to show that he's tough. When really, I think if Cena went all the way with the corny babyface and acted like a heel, people would be way more into him and would pay good money to see him get his ass kicked. I still think the thing about Bo Dallas, I still think he's too timid on some of his promos. But maybe that's part of the charm of the character. The substance of what he's saying is awesome. He comes out wearing a party hat with a kazoo. He talked about going to Cambodia and sports entertaining in front of 300,000 people. And then he had cookies handed out to all of his believers in the front row. Imagine the heel heat if John Cena came out on Raw one week and started handing vegetables out to kids in the front row. Nothing says heel heat more than broccoli and carrots. So the NXT GM, JBL, makes his way out to praise Bo Dallas before Sami Zayn interrupts. All the goofball and dingbat authority figures that we have to deal with on TV every week, and the best one they have is JBL, and he's on the Hulu show. Something wrong with that. He reinstates Sami Zayn, who he had previously suspended because, in his words, it was best for business. He says, not only is Sami reinstated, he's going to be part of a beat-the-clock challenge to determine the number one contender for Bo Dallas' NXT championship. I'm not the biggest fan of the beat-the-clock gimmick when they do it on Raw or on SmackDown. I think they use it as a crutch too often, but on this episode of NXT, it worked because it made these matches mean something for a change. Alexander Rusev beat Colin Cassidy in the first beat-the-clock match. Time to beat, 5 minutes, 33 seconds. No Enzo Amore with Cassidy. He's out with a broken leg. Cassidy got way more offense in on the Bulgarian. I want to make sure I get that right. I think in the past I've referred to him as the Hungarian. He is the Bulgarian Brute. And he got more offense in on him than I thought he would. It was actually a very competitive match. He even got to the ropes the first time Rusev put him in his camel clutch finish. But the second time was too much. Cassidy tapped out. I said it before, you're going to see Alexander Rusev on TV very soon. He is gigantic. I don't mean like jacked up gigantic, like Mason Ryan gigantic. I mean the dude is thick. He looks like a monster. And now he's got a hot chick in his corner, which is never a bad thing. They have a new backstage interviewer, this chick named Devin Taylor. She's no Renee Young. Let's just leave it at that. Renee is great. Renee has personality, and she sounds like she's actually interacting with the wrestler when she interviews them or reacting to them in the background. This one looks like the prototypical plastic woman who just stands there like a robot, spits out some standard questions, and just doesn't react. She interviewed Adrian Neville, who talked about Corey Graves being out with a concussion after their 2 out of 3 falls match last week. And tonight, he's in the Beat the Clock Challenge. She also interviewed Bayley backstage. And Bayley is adorable. Does it make me any less of a man to use that word? I was going to say cute, but cute's not strong enough. Adorable just seems like the right word to use here. She was dejected over Charlotte's betrayal last week, but she vowed revenge and did so in a very low-key manner, of course. she's gonna snap one day. I very much look forward to the day that Bayley just loses her shit and goes nuts on NXT. Cassius Ohno beat Tyler Breeze in another Beat the Clock match. Yes, Cassius Ohno pinned Tyler Breeze in 4 minutes 48 seconds, giving him, at least temporarily, the best time, and in theory, making him the number one contender to the NXT title. This was depressing. Good match, though. You know, for the first time since Breeze debuted, he took most of the offense here. He wasn't played for total comedy. There was a spot where Cassius Ohno falls to the floor, and Tyler Breeze goes out after him. And William Regal, it was Byron Saxton, Alex Riley, and William Regal on commentary. Regal absolutely loses it. Just, he cannot understand why Tyler Breeze would not just let him get counted out and get the best time. You know, why is he going out after him, he wants to know. And the man has a point. I think it was also during this match that Alex Riley got frustrated and he said, you know, how come I don't get asked more questions? Because there was a lot of back and forth with Byron Saxton and Regal, and I guess Riley felt left out. And Regal shot back with the best line ever. It's one of the many reasons why I love William Regal so much. He says, it's 30 years and 44 countries of experience, or 200 matches and carrying the Miz's bags. That probably has something to do with it. That was awesome. So yeah, I don't know if this was Ohno's final TV match or not. Maybe there were more tapings where we're going to see him pop up again. But if it was, if that was it for him, at least he went out a winner. It's the best thing I could say. Junico and Camacho won a squash. And for a change, they were the ones doing the squash and not being squashed. Devin Taylor ran out to interview them on the ramp. They said some stuff in Spanish, then in English, saying they're coming for the Ascension. Adrian Neville pinned Aiden English with his red arrow off the top rope to set a new time and Beat the Clock. 4 minutes, 45 seconds. And unfortunately, no encore from Aiden English this week. I guess when he loses, he's not in the mood to sing. Sami Zayn and Leo Kruger were in the final Beat the Clock match on the night. And speaking of Leo Kruger, it appears he may have undergone a gimmick change. He popped up at an NXT event this weekend with different gear and a different name. They're now calling him Adam Rose, which sounds totally generic. I was not the biggest, you know, Leo Kruger fan. Leo Kruger has a lot of people out there who like him. A lot of Leo Kruger supporters, I noticed. People who have emailed me. I never really could get into the guy. Maybe it was the gimmick, because as a wrestler, he's fine. So I don't have a problem if they want to change the guy's character just because it didn't work for me. But if they're just giving him a completely, like, a complete overhaul, and they're going to call him Adam Rose, if that's the best they could come up with for this guy, they're not doing him any favors. I mean, I may not have been a fan of the Leo Kruger character, but that doesn't mean you strip him all away and just give him a generic-sounding name. So hopefully they've got more in store for him than that. But anyway, Bo Dallas comes out on stage to scout his potential competition. They did a deal where Sami Zayn scored the pin on Kruger just as the clock hit zero. So he matched Adrian Neville's time of 4:45. So we had some drama here on NXT. Out comes JBL, who says there shall be no controversy during the Wrestling God's reign as GM. As much as he'd like to blame referee John Cone and send him back to Kansas City to work in a donut shop, he's instead going to make a match for next week between Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville to determine the number one contender, with the winner wrestling Bo Dallas for the title in 2 weeks. So I'm not sure if they worked together as Pac and Generico while they were both doing indies. I'm sure their paths must have crossed at some point. That should be a hell of a match, though, next week. Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville. I think that's something to look forward to right there. One other piece of NXT news. Eddie Edwards and Davey Richards from Ring of Honor, the American Wolves, appeared at Thursday's NXT tapings. They wrestled a match against the Ascension. They wrestled as the American Pitbulls instead of the American Wolves. They are not signed to a contract, so it's not like they've brought them in and, you know, this is their new name and their new gimmick or whatever. This was a tryout match. Apparently they were brought in to try to impress Triple H. So if he likes them, they'll get a contract. If he doesn't like them, and we know how Triple H feels about small guys, then they may not get a contract. Ultimately, it's his decision, whatever happens. They do want more tag teams, so you know, I think that works to their advantage. If they want more tag team wrestlers that they can bring up to the main roster, then you won't find two guys with better chemistry right now than those two. They've worked together for a while. They're a great team together. Individually, I don't see any real future for them in WWE. I think if they come in, it has to be as a tag team. Because there's just so many other guys right now. Individually, nobody gives a shit. Like, Davey Richards as a single isn't going anywhere in NXT. And as good as Eddie Edwards may be, he's not going anywhere either. So their best bet is to come in as a team, and we'll see what happens there. I can't imagine they'll let them use the American Wolves name anyway. If Pit Bulls is the name they get, if they sign, I have no problem with that. I think that's a cool name. I see nothing wrong with it. That match, by the way, is going to air on the December 18th episode of NXT, if you want to check that out. And apparently Big Dave Batista was also backstage at the NXT tapings this week, visiting. Probably nothing more. So it was good to see his name back in the news. So yeah, that was NXT. Really fun show this week. They're free. You can get them on Hulu.com. You don't have to pay for them anymore. So I would highly encourage you to check it out. And this week's episode in particular, I think there was a lot of good character development. There was some good action. And I think you'll enjoy it. Let's shift over to TNA. TNA had a big week. They were back in Universal Studios with a live edition of Impact, a free pay-per-view, as they like to call them, which is kind of an oxymoron, I think. Which is funny because TNA is, some might say, run by a moron, that being Dixie Carter, but nah, I'm kidding. I kid Dixie. In fact, before we get into any of this Turning Point stuff, I want to start out by talking about the Sports Illustrated article that was done on Dixie Carter this past week. She actually thought so highly of it that she came out on television, and the first thing she did was promote the fact that, hey, Sports Illustrated did an article about me. Go online and check it out. I have to give credit to Dixie. The article reads like a profile in Courage. They get into her background growing up when her family didn't have a lot of money, not as much as they do now, and they talk about her running her own PR firm. And as a public relations guy myself, I can tell you that this kind of story is the kind of story every PR person tries to get for their client. They love stories like this. It's what you call a fluff piece. I know of Loretta Hunt's work through her MMA coverage, and that one time Dana White referred to her using the C word. That's really how I first came to know her name. I don't know how she came together with Dixie or who pitched the piece, but my guess is that she saw this woman running a wrestling company, you know, the underdog, like the little engine that could, and she approached this as a female running a wrestling company in a predominantly male industry, probably approached it from that perspective, you know, female business leaders, that kind of thing. It's quite a coup for Dixie and TNA to get a piece like that on the Sports Illustrated website. I thought overall she came off really well. They talk about her background in marketing and PR, how she and her parents would have arguments during dinner, where she would sometimes walk away. Her parents were so upset about how much money they were putting into the company without getting that money back in return, and she just couldn't take it, and she would get up and walk away. I don't know what that says about her, but that's the story she told. So it's worth a read if you have a few minutes. I want to go through some of the gems that stood out to me in this article, and there were quite a few of them. The first one, they mentioned that TNA ratings have become so steady and reliable on Spike over its 8 years, with its, as this article points out, 1 to 2 million viewers per week, closer to one than two, let's be honest. And the article says that executives like to joke that they can set their watches to them. And I read that and I think to myself, well, at least they're consistent, but is that really something to be proud of? Shouldn't you want to grow your audience over the course of 8 years? Anyway, Dixie says, once we got on Spike, we changed a lot of things and our revenues grew. We've been cash flow positive for the last 4 or 5 years. After that point, Panda stopped putting money in the company. We funded it with every dollar we've made, and maybe that's kept us from growing quite as fast. The part about Panda no longer putting money into the company is interesting to me in that it doesn't verify the stories about them looking to sell an interest in the company, which they still deny, but it would make sense that they may want to remain, let's say, majority shareholders in the company, but bring in an investor who can help pump more money into the company and just ease the burden that they're probably under right now. If what she's saying is true, and God knows I'm skeptical of a lot of things that Dixie has said before, and this goes, by the way, for the president in any company. There was a story I saw this week where Stephanie McMahon was, I think, the keynote speaker at a conference here in New York. She was being honored as one of the most powerful women in cable television. And she gave this speech spitting out all these very impressive statistics about WWE and the build and the makeup of its audience and all this. And based on the transcript I read, she made a comment at one point that said, since we've gone to PG, we haven't lost any fans. Instead, we've only gained new ones. That's the biggest load of crap I've ever heard. This notion that ever since they went PG in 2008, we haven't lost any fans because of that. We've only gained new ones. And that's such a BS statement. And it's interesting to hear them speak. Like, I get where these people are coming from in that they're leading these companies. It's not like they're going to go out there and say bad things like, oh, you know, we've lost a whole bunch of fans. But don't just make up stupid shit like that. So it's not a Dixie Carter thing so much as it is a problem, I think, with a lot of people in power. But we're talking about Dixie here, and I would be skeptical about some of the things that she said. If what she's saying is true, she said they've been cash flow positive for 4 to 5 years. I think it's important to note the words that she used there. That doesn't mean that the company hasn't been losing money for the last 4 to 5 years. You could very well lose money and at the same time be cash flow positive. It means basically the income they're bringing in is more than their current expenses. Okay, although based on what she's saying here, not by much, which is probably why they don't have the money to stay on the road and they had to go crawling back to Universal, to a smaller space no less. It's not even as big as the old Impact Zone. And probably why there are reports of wrestlers and production people being paid late. So I thought it was interesting to note her use. It's not like she said, oh, you know, we've been in the black, you know, making money for 4 to 5 years. She said, no, we're cash flow positive. And I think some people might look at that and think to themselves, oh, well, you see, they've been making money. That's not what that means. There was another quote that I think is emblematic of a bigger problem in wrestling today, and this includes WWE. The story says, when Dixie is reminded of her pro wrestling naivete, okay, their words, not mine, Dixie says she's reminded of her father, who knew nothing of the power industry before founding Panda Energy, and he surrounded himself with other people who knew what the hell they were doing. And Dixie says, that's all any business is. You don't have to know wrestling. You'll know wrestling eventually. But business is about making good decisions, putting good people around you, and managing them. I think part of the reason wrestling is the way it is today is that very mindset. That you can bring people in who know nothing about wrestling and just expect to do well because they're good business people. Jim Herd was considered a good businessman when he became the head of WCW, and he nearly drove that company into the ground because he didn't know fuck all about wrestling. WWE, they're bringing in more and more business people who have no connection to pro wrestling, and they can run different divisions just fine. You know, they'll make money for the company. But then let's say you bring in guys who have influence over what you and I see on TV, and the results don't always jive. That guy they fired earlier this year, Eric Pankowski, the one who decided that having some random four-way match on Raw to determine Undertaker's WrestleMania opponent was a good idea. When apparently other people behind the scenes told him it was a bad idea, he went and did it anyway, got Vince to sign off on it, and then got shit-canned when people realized it was a bad way to pick an opponent for Undertaker at WrestleMania. There was no story to it. They just threw four guys in a ring. You know, pro wrestling, it's such a unique business. You can't really compare it to any other business, so you can't say that. You know, you don't have to know wrestling. Sure, you don't have to, but it would sure be nice. Clearly, this formula hasn't worked as well for Dixie as she would have hoped. In reference to the rumors of a potential TNA sale, she said, this type of reporting is totally unsubstantiated. The truth is that it's not the first time it's been reported. This is about the 10th, 11th, or 12th time over 11 or 12 years that this has been said, or that we're going out of business. I've been hearing this rumor since we were 4 weeks into the company. It's disappointing when a person makes a sweeping statement as fact. Whoever said TNA is going out of business? Maybe some idiots tweeted that to her. I've never read one credible website that has said anything about TNA about to go out of business or go belly up. I don't know where the hell she got that from. On Hulk Hogan, She said, yes, I think Hulk has been worth it. He's opened a lot of doors for us. When you're about to lose a deal in an international territory and one phone call from Hulk Hogan makes a man who doesn't even speak your language melt and you get your deal back, that carries a lot of weight. There's not another guy out there who could do that. She admits that if there was one thing she could have done differently with Hulk Hogan, it would have been changing the frequency in which TNA used him. She said, if we did anything wrong with him, we used him too much on television. The hell you say? It's nice to finally hear her admit that. It's actually kind of refreshing. And on the international stuff, it's probably true. You know, some people hear the name Hulk Hogan, and that could make all the difference. I don't doubt that. The thing is name-dropping Hulk Hogan and saving one or two TV deals overseas enough to justify whatever they were paying him and the other potential damage he was doing to your company? Apparently it was, because they wanted him back. They made him an offer, and Hulk turned them down. They still didn't learn their lesson. That's what I got out of that. Dixie also confirmed that AJ Styles still does not have a new deal in place with TNA. The belief is that the extension he signed lasts only through next month, so they better get that taken care of real quick, since their main storyline revolves around this guy, and he's the heart and soul of that company. They cannot afford to let him go, especially, you know, not after the way Hogan exited, with Dixie wrapped around his leg begging him to stay. They cannot afford to lose AJ Styles. On the road tapings, Dixie said, "We went on the road thinking if we could sell 1,500 to 2,000 tickets, we'd be good. We went with a very conservative budget. We did not come out here thinking we'd sell out arenas. The truth is that we exceeded those budget numbers. We hit our revenue numbers, but we overspent when it came to loading out of Universal Studio. There was a two-month overlap that cost us." I don't have a clue what she's talking about here. She cannot be saying that they underestimated the cost of moving out of Orlando and that was the sole reason why they had to get off the road all these months later. That cannot be right. I don't buy that for a second. And then there's this. They talked about TNA's new Impact 365 social media initiative, which I like. I think it's been a plus for the company. Is it going to mean anything to business? Probably not. But it's a fun thing for the fans, and you know, it's a creative outlet for the wrestlers. According to the article, in some cases, they actually give the wrestlers cameras to take home with them so they could film stuff and then send it to TNA. Here's what Dixie said about this. "Where our competitor has five shows, we only have 82 minutes a week. That's not enough time to get all that great talent over, and we have the greatest talent in the world." That's the quote that really irked me. I gave my thoughts about this on Twitter, and I'll say it again here. She says their competitor has five shows a week to get talent over, okay? Whereas TNA only has one. Here's the thing. She's right. WWE has many more hours per week of television. Something like 8 or 9 hours. And yet, they still can't get half their guys over. It's not like WWE has a roster full of guys who the fans care about. Look at how many guys they have under contract on the main roster, and how many of them are truly over as compared to the ones who aren't. I thought one of the ideas behind expanding Raw to 3 hours last year was to give these lower card guys more TV time so they'd get some exposure, and the fans would care about them. Well, they're getting the exposure, but not much else has changed. What Dixie needs to understand is very simple, okay? It's about making the most of what time you do have. If you know what you're doing, they will get over. That's why I hear that, and it's such a cop-out answer to me. You know, back in the day, Superstars was the main WWF show for me. I didn't have cable, and there was no Raw back then anyway. But, you know, Primetime Wrestling, All American Wrestling, all these other shows, I never saw them because I didn't have cable. Superstars was largely just a bunch of squash matches. But those matches helped get the stars over, and when they did a big angle, which they did every now and then, it stood out more. You didn't have the main guys on those shows every single week. You'd rotate them out. A guy like Hulk Hogan would hardly ever be on Superstars anyway. But a guy like Savage or Piper or Jake the Snake, or whoever, they weren't on the show every single week. So that they could feature other guys and debut new guys and get them over. I'm just using that as an example. Okay, don't send me angry emails asking me why I want to turn Impact into a squash show. I'm not saying that. But restructure your shows and make the most of the time that you do have. You know, a few years ago, Spike aired that reaction show when Impact went off the air. It was like an extra 30 minutes to help get over the angles that just aired. I liked it. It's a shame they got rid of it. But that was a Spike TV call. Just make the most of the time that you do have. Don't waste it on Hulk Hogan and Brooke Hogan every other segment. They're gone now. That's a good thing. But back then, the shows were all 1 hour. You've got 2 hours. You've got 2 hours of television every week. I don't buy that for a second. That's not enough time to get our guys over. That just means you're doing a really shitty job, if you really honestly believe that. It's just such a cop-out answer. Just make the most of the time that you do have, and your guys will get over. And if they don't, well, then, you know what? Maybe it's time to get somebody else in there to lead the company and take it in a different direction. Maybe that's the answer. Turning Point. I was really looking forward to Turning Point. I was looking forward more to Turning Point than Survivor Series. I said that to somebody on Twitter who asked me. And the show was good. It was a little underwhelming. I expected more out of it. It wasn't perfect, but it was still a good wrestling show. There was good things on it. The attendance in the new soundstage where their new home is at Universal was between 600 and 700 fans. I've seen the number 680 floated around. I don't know if that's capacity or not. It is smaller than the old Impact Zone. They could, I think, fit about 1,100 in there if they wanted to. So that may just be the number of people that we have there from now on. Instead of 1,000 or 1,100, it may just be 600 or 700. And to me, it didn't really look all that different. You could tell it was smaller, but for the most part, to me, it just looked like the old Impact Zone. It didn't look that much smaller. The people seemed to be into it, and there were parts they weren't. But, you know, no real major difference. We had the big story, of course, being the end of Aces and Eights. After 18 months, our long national nightmare is over. Mr. Anderson defeated Bully Ray in the main event. I like the way they did this, too, because you had to make it into a big deal. This has been the dominant storyline of this company now for the last year and a half. And you can't just have him beat Bully and have his hand raised and that's the end of it. Instead, they did this deal where he collected all of their cuts. I don't think Garrett Bischoff was even there. I don't know what's up with that. That's probably bad news. I don't even think he was mentioned at all. But they cut the vest off of Nux at one point, so he collected the vest from him. Later on, after the match was over, he beat Bully Ray with the mic check. I think it was a mic check on a chair, if I remember. They wanted to collect Taz's cut. And Taz, what they've done now in this new place is the announcers are no longer sitting at ringside. I guess maybe because of how much smaller it is. They're back to sitting in kind of the back of the new Impact Zone. So Anderson points to Taz and says, "I want your cut." And Taz says, "No, I ain't giving it to you. You're not getting my cut." Well, all of the TNA babyfaces had come out on stage to cheer on Anderson because it was like they're all so happy. They're so proud that Aces and Eights is no more. And you see Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe just very casually walk up to Taz like, "Okay, we could do this the easy way or we could do this the hard way." And Taz resists a little bit and he's like, "All right, fuck it." And he takes off his cut, gives it to him. I like that. I like the way they made this into a big... It's like when Team WWF beat the Alliance, you know, and they showed everybody in the back cheering and everything like that. And that was a big storyline, right? The power struggle that was ongoing. Thank God this is over. And that was probably the best thing about Eric Bischoff now being gone from the company is that this storyline is dead, it's over, and we can move on. Because Aces and Eights, it just never worked. And when Bully Ray turned heel and they did the big swerve at Lockdown, I actually thought that Bully doing the swerve, officially being, you know, named the president of Aces and Eights, because I was a big fan of Bully's work at that time, I thought maybe that was a turning point for the group. Maybe now the group will turn a corner and they'll actually start winning matches, which they weren't doing much of early on. And Bully could really make this work. And I'm sorry to say, as much as I like Bully, he didn't make it work. It only got progressively worse and worse and worse. And part of it was all the jobbers that they had as part of this group. No offense to a guy like Nux, but that's what he is. Nobody looks at Nux as a star. Nobody looks at Garrett Bischoff or Wes Briscoe as a star. Clearly, the idea was never to make those guys into stars. Like, you can have a faction like Evolution, right? I would imagine the whole idea behind Evolution was probably twofold. One, it's Triple H's storyline, so, you know, let's make him the dominant leader. He'll be the Ric Flair of this generation, and Triple H has to surround himself with people. He's done it his entire career. Look at all the managers and the bodyguards and the people that Triple H has had from the moment he came into the WWF. They put Mr. Hughes with him at one point for a cup of coffee. You know? They put Mr. Perfect with him, although that didn't last very long. China, Ric Flair became his manager. He was part of DX. Then he was part of the McMahon-Helmsley regime, corporation, whatever the hell it was. Then came Evolution. Now it's the Authority. You know, he's always surrounding himself with people. And when he's not surrounded by people, like when he was a babyface, like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and he won the title, remember, and he defended it against Orton at WrestleMania in one of the worst WrestleMania main events of the last 10 years. Was Triple H really that over? He was kind of boring and bland. So, I didn't mean to pick on Triple H here. I'm just using him as an example. You can have factions like Evolution where the idea is to build up these new guys. Orton and Batista were the chosen ones, right? Triple H, those were his guys. He was going to help make them into big stars. And to his credit, he did. Orton now is the face of the company. Batista became a huge star. Headlined WrestleMania, multiple world titles. Now he's a big movie star, right? Other factions, the goal isn't to get people over. It's just to have a heel faction that goes around as the badasses beating people up. So poor Garrett Bischoff, who nobody gave a shit about, and poor Wes Briscoe, who nobody gave a shit about, they never stood a chance. Because the goal was never to make them look good and get them over. So you knew that when this Aces and Eights thing finally ran its course, that was going to be it for them. And it looks like it may be. I don't know what their contract status is. We haven't seen Wes Briscoe since this ended. How do you even bring him back? Does he come crawling back begging for a job in TNA? Garrett Bischoff, I mean, I guess people liked him. I never heard that people behind the scenes, you know, didn't like him. But, you know, given the situation with his dad, it certainly makes you wonder that we've probably seen the last of him. So you look at Aces and Eights in totality. Taz couldn't take a bump. You couldn't even lay a finger on the guy because he's got a bad neck. So he stands there, and then every week he sits there at ringside. He's right there, you know what I mean? And nobody could touch him. He's just there. He contributed nothing to this faction, to this storyline. It was just they wanted to do a swerve, and they did it, and then it's like they didn't know what to do at that point. He just sat there with his vest on every single week. So everything about Aces and Eights was just a colossal fail. It's in their best interest to just move beyond this now and do something different, because I think this will go down as one of the darker periods in the history of TNA. And they've had some bad periods, but the Aces and Eights thing, to me, was a complete failure. You can argue that the one thing it did was help get Bully Ray over as a main event heel, but I don't believe that. I know that was the swerve, like in the end they told the story all along, I was part of Aces and Eights. But there were many months that went by where he had nothing to do with Aces and Eights, and Bully was getting himself over. He got himself in shape. His promos were always great. Even without Aces and Eights, he still would have been up there. Who really benefited from Aces and Eights? Anderson? I mean, how long is that really going to last? I mean, right now, yeah, he's a great babyface. You know why? Because he killed the group. In 2 weeks from now, people will probably forget all about it. And I don't want to hear that, you know, after all these months, the only thing we could say about Aces and Eights is that it got Ken Anderson over as a babyface, because that, to me, is the ultimate fail, if that's the only thing that we could glean from this whole Aces and Eights debacle. So Aces and Eights is finally over, and that's the first time in 18 months you've probably ever heard anybody say those words. Magnus beat Samoa Joe in a Falls Count Anywhere match to advance in the TNA title tournament. I thought this was kind of a lame match, to be honest with you. First of all, Samoa Joe, we all know Joe's a great wrestler. Joe needs to lose some weight, like, desperately. I mean, every time I look at him, he seems to get bigger and bigger, and now he's doing the Sting thing, where he wears a t-shirt on television every week, which is probably good for all of us. I'm not complaining about that. But usually when you have to wear a t-shirt, that's probably a sign that you are having either some sort of cosmetic issue that bothers you, or there's got to be some reason for it. So I just think Joe would really benefit by losing 30 or 40 pounds. I don't expect Samoa Joe to ever be skinny, but he's getting larger by the week, and I think it's affecting his matches. I watch his matches now, and it just feels like he's moving slower. And I just wasn't really a big fan of this match, the way they laid it out and everything. And it made Joe look kind of weak, the way the finish went down. But Magnus advances. The other tournament match was Bobby Roode and James Storm, which was supposed to be a bull rope match. And they changed it to a Florida death match. I've never even heard of a Florida death match. I'd imagine there probably were back in the day in Florida Championship Wrestling. Maybe. I don't know. But they did this angle that they aired on YouTube where Bobby Roode attacked James Storm at a bar in Orlando. And that led to James Storm coming out, being very upset, and that's why he got the match changed to a death match, which basically had the same rules as a last man standing match. So, for all intents and purposes, that's what it was. So, they had a good match. I Bobby Roode is one of the more underrated guys they have in that company right now. I'm such a big fan of his work, and hope that going forward they've got more, in the pipeline for him, even if whoever wins this tournament, I'm still thinking it's Magnus. If it's Bobby Roode, that's great, because that puts him firmly in the main event picture. But I'm thinking he and Kurt Angle are going to cancel each other out. He's beaten Kurt twice. He's tormenting Kurt Angle. They're both still in the tournament. If they don't wrestle each other in the finals, I think one will end up, helping eliminate the other. And Magnus will end up with the belt. But whatever the case may be, I would not mind seeing eventually an AJ Styles-Bobby Roode feud for the championship. So he was really good here. He got the win when Gunner, James Storm's tag team partner, came out and threw in the towel when Bobby Roode was about to dump James Storm on a barbed wire board. So the story is that he saved his partner from a potentially career-ending injury. James Storm was none too happy with Gunner when the match was over, and jaw jacked back and forth. There was another segment after they came back from commercial where it's basically James Storm walked away from Gunner and left Gunner behind. And so I don't know if somebody's doing a turn, if there's a patented swerve in the mix here somewhere, or what the deal is. James Storm has certainly been knocked down a few pegs. Here's a guy that briefly held the World Heavyweight Championship and was in the main event mix, and he's been relegated back to the tag team scene for a while. He hasn't really been doing much. I don't know that that's going to change anytime soon, that they're going to move him back up into a main event position. So maybe they do a split, and then he feuds with Gunner. Maybe Gunner goes heel. I don't know what the idea here is, but I did enjoy the match. What I didn't enjoy was the swerve on the Joe Park stuff. They did this angle the week before where Joseph Park says, you know what, to prove all the naysayers wrong and to shut up bad influence, I'm going to issue a challenge to my brother Abyss to a match for Impact next week, that being this past Thursday. And I was very curious to see how they were going to handle this, because we all know Joe Park and Abyss are one and the same. I thought maybe they'd put somebody else in the Abyss costume like they did once before and do whatever they're going to do. Or maybe they would just blow off the whole thing finally. And however they do it, just come out and have it revealed that in fact they are the same person. But they didn't do that. They didn't do anything, in fact. They had Joe Park come out. Bad Influence came out. They insulted him. They berated him. We waited and waited and waited. They played Abyss's music. Nobody came out. And Joe Park looked dejected. And then, again, they're bullying this guy. And Chris Daniels goes, oh, I know what sets you off. The blood, right? It's blood that sets you off. And I think it was Kazarian who snuck up from behind. And they dumped a bucket of fake blood over Joe Park's head. Now, the whole thing, I always thought it was Joe Park's own blood. They were talking like, it's the blood that sets him off. Even on commentary, Mike Tenay's like, oh, I can't believe it. Normally when there's blood on Joe Park, he morphs. And I'm thinking, I thought the whole point of the story was that it's his own blood. Like, when he gets busted open, he looks at his own blood. So they're changing that aspect of the story, apparently. But Joe Park just walked out. He took all the verbal abuse, he was drenched in fake blood, and he left. So that was lame. Here I was genuinely curious to see how they were going to handle this whole thing, and it was just a complete waste of time. So I thought that was really stupid. Gail Kim beat Candice LeRae from Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. Her open challenge storyline continues. She beat her in about 2 minutes with Eat Defeat. I still figure in the end it's just, one week she's going to come out and say, okay, I've gone through all this competition, there's nobody left, and they're just going to have Lady Tapa turn on her and beat her and win the championship. So we'll see if that is in fact how it culminates, or if they have maybe a new female that they're going to sign and use this angle as a way to introduce her. I figure it's going to be Lady Tappa, though. That's my guess. We had Ethan Carter III on the show, who wrestled against Shark Boy, this TNA legend that they were hyping was going to be making his return. It turned out to be Shark Boy. So he beat Shark Boy. I still am not buying this whole Ethan Carter thing. It's not going anywhere. You know, I'm not as into the character as I thought I would be at the beginning. What I did like, though, in terms of new talent, and we'll see where they go with this, I thought this was kind of interesting. They had a pre-tape, a segment that was done, I guess, earlier in the day with Christy Hemme in the apartment of Sam Shaw. Sam Shaw, you may remember, was one of the gut check guys, one of the few who survived and they actually still have under contract. He looked a little bit different. I think his hair was different or whatever. So yeah, he's been probably in OVW for a while now. He's been off TV for quite some time. And Christy Hemme is in his apartment and she's interviewing him. And he tells her, I want to be known as Samuel Shaw, not Sam. So there's your first sign right there that this guy's coming in as a heel. And, you know, he shows her around the apartment and I think and talks about some like his artwork and all this stuff. And he asks her out on a date. He says, let me take you out to dinner. Let me get your phone number. And Christy's like, oh, well, okay. And she writes, if only I knew it were that easy. And so she writes her number down, and they hug, and she leaves. And the camera stays on him. His demeanor all of a sudden turns very, very stoic. And he adjusts some of the things on his desk in such a way that makes me wonder if part of his gimmick is that he's OCD. Maybe I read too much into it. But when I saw him do that, I thought maybe that's going to be part of his character. But whichever direction it goes in, they got me interested. I am interested to see where they go with this guy going forward. It was one of those things where they're trying to introduce some new faces. There's nothing wrong with that. Here's a guy that you know went through the whole gut check thing. They did nothing with. All those other people, all the other bodies that fell to the wayside. What a talk about colossal failures. You think back to gut check. So if they actually have a plan for this guy, I think that's pretty cool. I have not read the Impact spoilers. I know they taped a whole bunch of shows. I know they taped a whole bunch of shit out of order. So you probably read those taping results and it makes no sense. I haven't read any of that yet, so I don't know what's in store over the next couple of weeks. I guess I'll just watch and find out. But I did enjoy that aspect of it. That really was all that I had to say about Impact. I thought it was good. It wasn't great. It was good. It didn't quite meet my expectations. They ran an ad for Genesis, which is going to be emanating from Huntsville, Alabama on January 16th. That's a Thursday night. So it's another one of these live and free on Spike TV episodes of Impact. I think Genesis was supposed to be one of the four pay-per-views TNA had left during the year. I think it was supposed to be Genesis, Lockdown, Slammiversary, and Bound for Glory. So I don't know if they've reduced that number down to three. You know, at this point, the best way to make Bound for Glory feel special, besides booking an actual show people want to see, might just be for them to make it their sole pay-per-view event all year. Their one truly big show, it's the one you have to pay for. It's time for the mailbag. If you have questions, please email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. We also accept audio questions. Try to keep them to about 30 seconds or so, MP3 format only. And please include the text of your question in the body of the email, in addition to the attachment. Richard writes in, I just finished a report on Bleacher Report about WCW Monday Nitro's final show in Panama City Beach, and my mind was blown hearing workers of all sorts, from backstage people, technical people, the wrestlers themselves, talking about the feelings they were experiencing the night of the last show. It was just brutal stuff. My question is, just how brutal was it to watch that last show emotionally? Did you feel bittersweet about it because of what would happen to the staff? Also, if TNA were to use foreign talent on Impact, do you think that could give them a chance to create some popularity? The article Richard is referring to was written by Keith Elliott Greenberg, who's the same guy that wrote the awesome piece on the last days of Randy Savage earlier this year. I have not yet read it, but I have it bookmarked. It's a really long read, but it looks like a good one. It's called An Oral History of the Last WCW Monday Nitro. It's up on Bleacher Report. I felt bad for the guys who were out of a job. You know, I was sad that there wasn't going to be another company to compete with WWE anymore. That sucked. But WCW was so far gone by that point that, you know, the product was so terrible, I didn't really care all that much, to be honest with you. I didn't care enough to think it was bittersweet. You know things are bad when Ric Flair, the face of that company going back to the NWA days, says that night he was happy and he was relieved to see it all end. You know, it just wasn't the same company anymore. As far as TNA using foreign talent, it'd be nice here and there, but I'd rather they spend their time getting their own guys over. You know, if they want to bring guys over from Japan to help get their own talent over, that's great, but who are they going to get? You know, it's amazing to think that at different points, TNA had both Hiroshi Tanahashi and Kazuchika Okada on their roster, and today they're probably the two best wrestlers in the world. They had Okada losing matches on Explosion. It's not even like he was wrestling on Impact. He was wrestling on their version of Main Event. They didn't bring those two guys in and scare them away by treating them like garbage the whole time. You know, who knows? Maybe they'd be tearing it up in TNA right now and not New Japan. WWE is not much better when it comes to bringing in international talent. I mean, Alberto Del Rio, they brought up from Mexico. He's been very successful, but the well runs pretty dry after that, especially when it comes to Japanese talent. I'm not saying Yoshitatsu should be WWE champion, but he should have been given a chance, and he never really was. He's just one example. David from Sacramento, California. I know in the early days of Survivor Series, basically the entire card was Survivor Series matches. My question is, do you feel Survivor Series should basically be a pay-per-view where the main championships are not defended? Perhaps have a U.S. or Intercontinental title match, a tag title match, but the rest of the card should be traditional Survivor Series matches. I personally would book the pay-per-view this way to highlight the other titles that are normally overshadowed by the World and WWE Championship matches. No, I don't think that would work. See, I'm a big proponent of the Survivor Series elimination matches, but the format of having almost all Survivor Series matches, that's not something that's going to work. And you need to have at least one world title match on the pay-per-view. You don't necessarily need both, but you got to have at least, you know, a WWE Championship match. And that goes back to 1991. That's not like a new phenomenon. Like the fourth or fifth pay-per-view they ever did, they were already introducing, you know, championship matches in addition to the elimination matches, because I think they realized, okay, we have to have something on the line here. We have to have at least one championship up for grabs. In 92, they just almost completely abandoned the whole format. That I didn't like. Even though looking back, it really wasn't a bad show. After that, they went back to having more elimination matches. But you can go back to the early 90s, they were having title matches. That's fine. I think you need to. You have to have at least one championship match, main championship, defended on that show. So I don't think that would be that good of an idea, to be honest with you. Michael wants to know, I was listening to a shoot interview with Vince Russo from a few years ago. He was talking about the 2000 Bash at the Beach incident and how Booker T ended up being chosen to hold the WCW title. Vince says the booking committee was all in agreement to give Booker the title because of a lawsuit they were in at the time. What lawsuit was he referring to, and does it boil down to Booker only getting the belt because he was black? That was the Sonny Ono racial discrimination lawsuit he filed against WCW the same year that Booker T won the championship. It got settled out of court. I'm sure Ono got a nice settlement out of it. He was Eric Bischoff's friend. Bischoff brought him into the company. When he first came in, he was this Japanese photographer guy. I actually thought he was kind of funny in the character, and eventually he turned into a heel manager for some of the foreign talent, and he filed the lawsuit after Bischoff was already gone from the company. Bischoff had already been ousted, and he claimed he was given a disrespectful gimmick and that he was not being paid commensurate with what other wrestlers were being paid at the time, which, if I'm understanding that correctly, I've always thought that was a joke. Sonny Ono on the WCW roster was a minor character at best. I certainly hope he wasn't expecting to be paid along the lines of what some of the higher talent was. But WCW was so fucked back then. I mean, they would sign guys. You talk about nepotism and all this other stuff. I mean, they signed Lanny Poffo to a contract because of his connections. You know, his brother Hogan. They signed him to a contract that supposedly was in the high six figures. He was probably making $500,000 a year. I don't remember him making one single appearance in the ring for WCW. Not on TV, anyway. So they would sign guys, they would sit at home, and they would collect hundreds of thousands of dollars. per year. And so you know what? Maybe in that respect, Sonny Ono wasn't wrong. He felt he wanted a bigger piece of the pie. But anyway, that was the whole nature of the lawsuit. And if I remember correctly, they also claimed that Vince Russo was a racist. I remember hearing that was one of the things that I think he and his attorney had claimed when Russo had come in late 99, that you know, he was a racist. And who knows if he is or he isn't. But there were a lot of black wrestlers who also filed suit against WCW for racial discrimination around the same time. It came out at the time that one WCW referee who was brought in to testify as part of the suit had claimed the only reason Booker T won the world title was because the company was feeling pressure and they wanted to put the title on a black wrestler. You know, Russo loved to claim at the time that he was a big fan of Booker T's work and he wanted to put the title on him because he was underutilized. Even in that shoot promo at the Bash at the Beach, I think he was like heaping all this praise on him. This is the same fucking guy who turned Booker T back into G.I. Bro for a month or two before he won the world title. Think about that. What sense would it really have made to do that if his plan all along was to put the world title on the guy? He was just G.I. Bro. He went right from G.I. Bro to world heavyweight champion. Something happened. They had no big plans for him. I don't buy that for a second. And he can claim whatever he wants to in interviews today, but if his lips are moving, he's probably lying. Alex writes in, if WWE is so concerned about being a PG company that is politically correct, then why are all their new wrestlers who are of any international descent portrayed as racial stereotypes and have no individual personality? Just look at Los Matadores, Junico and Camacho, R-Truth, Great Khali, Jinder Mahal, etc. Well, R-Truth is hardly a new wrestler, and I don't think I'd classify him as an international wrestler, but your point is well taken. That's just the mentality of the people who run that company. You forgot to throw in almost any Asian wrestler who's made it to the main roster. Don't forget about them. According to WWE, none of them can speak any English and they bow a lot. That's what I've learned over the years. Steven from the Isle of Man, UK writes in, whatever happened to Monty Brown? I remember him being on WWE's version of ECW and getting a decent amount of TV time, and then all of a sudden he was nowhere to be seen. Did he fall into their bad books or something? Also, how far do you think Monty could have gone in WWE, and what were your thoughts on him? Yeah, that's right. I almost forgot about him. In ECW, they changed his name to Marcus Corvan. I liked Monty Brown. You know, he did the alpha male gimmick in TNA, got over. I don't remember why he left TNA. He may have been unhappy. I don't quite remember what the reason was that he left there, but I know what happened in WWE. It wasn't that they, you know, just stopped booking him or he got heat or anything like that. I remember there being a personal situation. I think, and I could be wrong about this, but I think his sister either died or had gotten very sick with cancer or something happened, I think, with a sister. And he had to basically take over raising her kids. And so he got out of wrestling completely, and I don't think he ever went back. So that was just a personal situation in his life that came up. I think he could have been, I mean, look at the push they're giving now to Big E Langston. He reminds me a lot of Big E Langston. Monty Brown was the kind of guy that could just run through you like a freight train. He did the pounce, which was a fun move. I could see that getting over big in WWE. And he had the size. And there are some people who don't think that Vince McMahon wants there to be a black champion. They don't consider The Rock to really be black, so that doesn't count. And so there'll never be a black champion. And I always laugh at that because if Vince McMahon didn't like black people, right, he wouldn't push black people. Like, if he thought he could make money off a black person being WWE champion, then guess what? They would have been champion. I still maintain that if he never would have left the company, at some point Bobby Lashley would have been the first true black WWE champion. But shit happened. He left the company. And it never worked out. And they really have never had another guy. I mean, Mark Henry was the world heavyweight champion. I know it wasn't the WWE title, but they pushed Mark Henry as world champion. They didn't have to. Henry's been under contract for almost 20 years. But he did some of the best work of his career only in the last few years, and they rewarded him for it. He was great. The start of his world title run, the whole, you know, Hall of Pain thing, I thought that was great. That was the best Mark Henry's ever looked. So I think if the right person came along and they thought he could draw and that he could make money and people were into him, Are you kidding me? They put the title on that guy in a heartbeat. Maybe Big E Langston's going to end up being that guy at some point. He's already got John Cena as a friend of his behind the scenes. That can't hurt him. If anything, I'm sure that could only help. But yeah, this notion that, oh, he doesn't like black people. Look at the way he's booked them. Look at the way he's booked every ethnicity, every race, every creed. I mean, give me a break. It's not a black thing or a white thing. It's just a stupid wrestling thing. I agree, it's so dumb. Back in the day, Slick eating fried chicken out of a bucket, talking about eating Yardbird. And the way they booked a lot of other, Crime Time. You know, they've done this shit for years, but it's not just with black people. I just talked about it. Asian people, every person that looks Arab must be a terrorist and they must wear a turban. Like, it's just, these are the idiots who run wrestling. That's just the way it is, unfortunately. CJ writes in, I was on YouTube the other day, and in an interview, Ric Flair said that he no longer is friends with Arn Anderson, but he didn't say why. Do you know what happened between Rick and Arn, and if they have made up since? I don't know how old that interview is that you saw. I think they're on better terms now, but there was a period where Arn Anderson's wife was really good friends with Rick's second wife, Beth, and when Beth split from Rick, and it was not an amicable split, it caused all sorts of problems, and it probably put Arn Anderson in a really tough spot, and I think he had to kind of side with his wife, and that led to the rift. So my guess is that's probably what Flair was referring to. This comes from Rayvon Adamson. Do you think if Bret Hart did not get a concussion in 99 and was still wrestling when WCW was sold in 01, that WWF would have wanted him to be part of the Invasion storyline? Of course they would have. Absolutely. And I think he would have turned them down because those wounds were still very fresh from Montreal and Owen and everything else. And I think that would have been a big mistake for his career if he would have said no to that. He could have been a big focal point of what could have been the biggest storyline in the history of wrestling if they would have played their cards right. You know, opportunities like that don't come along very often. It wasn't until he did have the stroke and he got that phone call from Vince McMahon when he was laid up in the hospital that, Bret even started to make peace with Vince. So, yeah, I'm sure they would have wanted him in a heartbeat. Just like they wanted him for WrestleMania 22. They wanted to do Bret and Vince. And they wanted Shawn to be involved. They had this big plan, and Bret turned him down. Bret said, I'll do the Hall of Fame, but I'm not wrestling. So even 2006, he was still holding on to that, that feeling, that dignity, like, I can't go back. And, of course, eventually he did go back. As far as the second question is concerned, he has a second question here. Out of all the WWE champions in history, who do you think was the worst drawing champion of all time? And that, that's kind of an impossible question to answer. If you literally look at every WWE champion, look at Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan was champion for what? A day? Would you consider him technically to be the worst drawing champion of all time? I don't see how you can. He never even had the chance to draw. Rey Mysterio, he won the title, and he lost it the same night he won it. So it's all a matter of perspective. I go back to Kevin Nash. I say Diesel. I think Kevin Nash is probably the worst drawing champion in WWE history. He had the title for a full year. So he had an established, lengthy body of work, and he was a total bust as the champion. He got more over when he lost the title and came out on Raw the next night as this cool heel character that never had really been done in WWF before. He was a heel, but not completely. He got more over doing that than he was when he was champion. And they did some awful business in 1995. So if I had to pick one person, I would go with Kevin Nash. You can say, oh, this guy only held the belt for a day or 2 hours, but you can't count those guys. Those guys never really had a run. Kevin Nash had a whole fucking year. It's well established, his 1 year run as champion, and it was not a good one. Tribeca from New Jersey, longtime listener since the episode where you talked about Goldberg destroying Sid's car. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. In your opinion, well, I don't know who else's opinion it would be, who had the more successful WWE run before jumping ship to WCW? Scott Hall as Razor Ramon or Kevin Nash as Diesel? Well, here I just got done answering another question and talking about what a shitty run Diesel had as champion in 95. But I'm going to say Kevin Nash did. He was still the champion. Okay, he may not have been a great drawing champion, but he was still WWE champion. He was the guy for an entire year. He was in a bunch of pay-per-view main events in 95 and a few big matches in 96 on his way out, too. You know, so I think Nash, easy. He was the champ. He made more money. He may not have had as many good matches as Scott Hall did. You know, if you mean who was more successful in terms of quality matches, then you can make an argument for Scott Hall. But Diesel was more successful overall, easily. Razor came in with a bigger push right out of the gate. You know, he was tagging with Ric Flair at Survivor Series against Savage and Mr. Perfect. And then a couple of months later, he wrestled Bret Hart for the WWF title at the Royal Rumble. But after that, you know, he was at the Intercontinental level. He had a great run. He had more IC titles than anyone in history up to that point. By the time he left, I think he was a four-time Intercontinental Champion. The ladder match with Shawn Michaels, the second ladder match with Shawn, which often gets overlooked, but may have actually been a better match. He single-handedly helped make Shawn Waltman a name in that company. But Nash came in, he was the bodyguard for a while, then they gave him the monster spot, remember that, in the Royal Rumble in 94. Where he dumped like seven or eight guys. And you knew they were going to do something with this guy, although it took a little bit longer. He won the Intercontinental title. He won the tag team titles. He held those simultaneously. He pinned Bob Backlund in 8 seconds at Madison Square Garden and held the title for a year. So he may have been a bomb, but he was still a bigger star. Razor did shit after he lost the Intercontinental title to Goldust. I think he beat the 1-2-3 Kid in a diaper match. Then he was supposed to have that backlot brawl with Goldust at WrestleMania, and he got suspended. So he wasn't even on the show. And then Vader squashed him in an undercard match at the next pay-per-view. Literally, he was squashed. He sat on him. He pinned him. Kevin Nash, I mean, look at the way Vince McMahon booked Kevin Nash after he lost the title to Bret Hart. Like I said before, he was the first cool heel in that company. He would slap hands with the fans, but only the ones who would wear black diesel gloves. He flipped The Undertaker the bird at the Royal Rumble, which was something that you didn't see back then. He wrestled Undertaker at WrestleMania, which is a pretty high-profile match on that show. And he was in the main event on the pay-per-view for the title against Shawn Michaels on his way out, and probably had the best match of his career. They both did very well for themselves. But Diesel was way more successful than Razor Ramon. Same goes for the two bozos who played Diesel and Razor when they resurrected the gimmicks after Hall and Nash already left for WCW. That guy who played Diesel, I think he went on to do big things, or so I'm told. The one who played Razor, not so much.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we've got even more Survivor Series notes this week. 30 years ago this week, on November 24th, 1983... was the very first Starrcade, titled A Flair for the Gold, which was held at the Greensboro Coliseum in the Carolinas. Roddy Piper beat Greg Valentine in their infamous dog collar chain match, where Valentine busted one of Piper's eardrums with the chain. And Ric Flair defeated Harley Race inside a steel cage to win his second NWA World Heavyweight Championship. 23 years ago this week, on November 22nd, 1990, Survivor Series took place on pay-per-view, featuring two memorable debuts, one being The Undertaker. You might have heard of that guy. He was managed by Brother Love at the time, and the other being a little more infamous, the Gobbledygooker. Yes, WWE had this giant egg that they kept promoting and saying it would hatch at the Survivor Series. Rumors were flying. Maybe it was Ric Flair who was going to pop out of the egg. Gene Okerlund on the pay-per-view even teased that it could be the Playmate of the Month. But instead, we got Hector Guerrero dressed in a turkey costume. At least I think it was a turkey costume. It looked more like an inbred turkey to me. It was the sort of thing you look at and you just say, you know, kill it with fire. That's what the Gobbledygooker was. And we might just see the return of the Gooker on Raw this week, or so I hear. That should be something. This is still one of my favorite Survivor Series pay-per-views. It included the grand finale match that they only did once. I don't know why they never brought it back, but the way it worked was very simple. The sole survivors of their respective elimination matches would come back out at the end of the show for a grand finale match of survival, with both teams divided up evenly along heel and babyface lines. So it was Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, and Tito Santana. Which one of those does not fit? I'll give you 3 seconds to guess. Well, I guess they needed a good worker in there, and Tito was quite good, so that's why he got the nod. That, and they needed somebody to do the job and take the fall. Hogan and Warrior survived. They beat Ted DiBiase, The Model Rick Martel, The Warlord Hercules, and Paul Roma. I used to love when they would give these guys actual team names. They don't do that anymore because they don't have as many of these matches anymore. Now it's just, you know, Team Blank against Team Blank, which is very original. On this show, we had the Million Dollar Team against the Dream Team, the Vipers against the Visionaries, which made sense because Rick Martel had blinded Jake the Snake in an angle the month before, hence the Visionaries. The Alliance against the Mercenaries. Everything now is just so homogenized. It's just, ugh. 18 years ago this week, on November 19, 1995, one of my favorite Survivor Series shows. Ironically, in a year that was one of my least favorite years, probably, in WWF. It was the first Survivor Series ever to be held on a Sunday, which would become the norm. Up to this point, they were always held on Thanksgiving Day. Later on, it was Thanksgiving Eve. I miss those days when it was the Thanksgiving Eve tradition. WWE has done a very good job of taking a big old dump on tradition when it comes to Survivor Series these days. Mr. Perfect made his WWF return to open the show. He joined the announce team on commentary. He still was not wrestling due to an old back injury and a very nice insurance policy that he was collecting on from Lloyd's of London. The opening match of Survivor Series was an elimination match with a lot of undercard guys. So you had the Body Donnas, you had Rad Radford, the late Louis Spicoli. You know, Bob Holly was in there, Marty Jannetty, Barry Horowitz. Barry frickin' Horowitz got the biggest push of his career in 1995. I think that says it all about what was going on in that company at that time. Hakushi was in there. Hakushi was a great wrestler who deserved better. There's another guy, another Asian wrestler who deserved better than what he got. And I don't know why he never got a bigger push. All these guys are in this match, and you think to yourself, whatever, you know, it's a bunch of undercard guys. Who really cares? Go back and watch this match. Seriously, if you have to pick one match from this pay-per-view, go back and watch that match. It was the Body Donnas, Rad Radford, and the 1-2-3 Kid, who had just turned heel, against Holly, Jannetty, Horowitz, and Hakushi in a traditional elimination match. There is a spot in this match that just blows me away now when I go back and watch it, let alone back then when I didn't see a lot of risque wrestling moves going on in the WWF. There is a spot where Marty Jannetty gives Chris Candido a powerbomb off the top rope. I was amazed the first time I saw that. The heels got the win in the end. 1-2-3 Kid pinned Jannetty to win the match for his team. I still maintain this is one of the more underrated matches in Survivor Series history, with one of the sickest spots that you'll see in a Survivor Series match. So go out of your way to find it. I'm sure it is on YouTube. And in fact, a little tip for you. If you go on YouTube and you type in the names of some of these pay-per-views and type the words full show, there are a ton of full pay-per-views that people have uploaded to YouTube. I don't know if Survivor Series 95 is one of them, but go on there and look. You can find them. They're the full shows, 2 hours, 3 hours. This is one that you should go look for. There was a Survivor Series elimination match involving the lady wrestlers. Bertha Faye, Aja Kong, Tomoko Watanabe, and Linus Asuka, who beat the women's champion Alundra Blaze, Kyoko Inoue, Chaparita Asari, and Saki Hasegawa. And I had to look these names up because there's no fucking way I was going to remember them. I do remember Bertha Faye, Aja Kong, Alundra Blaze, and actually Saki Hasegawa for whatever reason. I remember her name. The other ones I had forgotten. Now, not a match that many people probably were into back then because, you know, even then WWF really didn't put a whole lot of emphasis on women's wrestling. And for this show, they brought in a bunch of Japanese lady wrestlers that I don't really remember them introducing us to them at all in the weeks leading up to the show. They just wanted to have this women's match with a bunch of Japanese workers on it. And it was good. I mean, it probably could have been better. I would imagine some of these women are probably a lot better than they were on the show. But, you know, I have more of an appreciation now when I go back and watch it than I probably did back then. I probably was like a lot of people back then, like, who cares? But apparently WWF didn't care either. You know, because it was very shortly after this event was over that Alundra Blaze was released from her contract, even though she was the women's champion still. They decided to do away with the division And so Blaze went and signed with WCW to return under her old Medusa name. And when she did, she showed up on Nitro with the WWF Women's title, which she proceeded to drop into a trash can on live TV. Now, she claims it was an Eric Bischoff idea, which I'm sure it was, and that she didn't want to go through with it. Basically, it got her blackballed from WWF after that. And she hasn't been back since. And really, it was, I don't want to say a turning point, because it would be many more months before WCW would overtake WWF in the ratings, but it was certainly one of the more defining moments of the Monday Night War. If you have to put a reel together of clips, of like the top 10 clips that people think of from those days of the Monday Night Wars, obviously there'd be a lot of NWO stuff in there, and a lot of Austin stuff, but Medusa dropping that belt in the trash can would have to be in the top 5. It would have to be. It was a big deal when that happened. It's things like that that make me feel sorry for the newer fans and the younger people today. They'll never have any real concept of this kind of stuff. This will never happen again in our lifetime. It's a big part of what made wrestling so must-see back then and so much fun. We had a wild card match on this show. There's another one of those matches that I don't know why they never did another one, but I thought it was a great concept back then. It was basically Gorilla Monsoon was the president, and he said, we're going to have a wild card match. And what that meant was, it was two teams mixed up with heels and babyfaces. So on one side, you had Shawn Michaels, Ahmed Johnson, who were babyfaces, teaming up with Sid and Bulldog, who were heels, against Razor Ramon, Owen Hart, Dean Douglas, and Yokozuna. So actually, on that team, Razor was the only babyface. Shawn Michaels nailed Yokozuna with some sweet chin music. Ahmed Johnson got the pin after a big splash. And so the babyfaces won. Actually, Bulldog, too. Bulldog survived. So he was the lone heel on that team who actually was still there at the end. But yeah, don't know why they never did another one of these. The main event was Bret Hart and Diesel for the WWF Championship, which was probably the best of their three-match series, although I did like their King of the Ring 94 match. I thought their match at the Royal Rumble in 95 sucked. I thought it was just ungodly boring. This match at least had a cool finish and a big turn at the end. You know, it was the Diesel tweener turn. You can't really call it a heel turn. It was the tweener turn. He lost. As soon as he lost, the camera zoomed in on him, and they showed him dropping an F-bomb, and, you know, then he went and powerbombed Bret Hart a couple of times. So that was a pretty big moment at the end of that pay-per-view. This match also marked the first time the Spanish announce table was ever destroyed on a WWE pay-per-view. So this was very historic for a number of reasons. The night after, on Monday Night Raw, talk about Shawn Michaels collapsing during a match with Owen Hart, right? I talked about that earlier briefly. This is the show where that happened. Shawn came out. He had a match with Owen. He started to feel a little woozy, and he fell down and collapsed. And the way they played this off, you know, they played this off like this was a major situation that was not planned. Shawn was in this great state of distress. Even Vince McMahon got up from the announce table. He came into the ring. The paramedics came in. Over on Nitro, they were airing the first ever singles match between Hulk Hogan and Sting. And I remember flipping between the two shows. There was no DVR back then. That was one of the most fun parts about the Monday Night Wars, and also probably one of the most infuriating, because you always felt like you were missing something big on the other channel. The Hogan deal was weird. This was a full 8 or 9 months before he turned heel with the NWO, but here he was flirting with the dark side, and he was feuding with the Dungeon of Doom, so he wasn't really a heel, but he wrestled for a while dressed in all black, just like Hollywood Hogan. No mustache. His mustache had been shaved off in an angle. So if you want to see what Hulk Hogan looks like without the Fu Manchu in all black, check out this match. It was almost like a test run, it felt like, for Hollywood Hogan the year before, but that really wasn't the intent, I don't think. Mongo McMichael was on commentary saying, hey, you're getting Sting vs. Hogan for free on TV when you should be getting it on pay-per-view. Yeah, no shit. I blame WCW for that problem. Giving away pay-per-view caliber matches on free TV. They were the ones who started doing it, and now WWE does it all the time. They did it this week. It's a big part of why people don't buy pay-per-views anymore. I mean, why bother? You can blame online streaming and piracy all you want, but if you give people matches they really want to see that they know they can't get just by putting on Raw, I think most people will pay for it. I really do. I really believe that. When you have 3 hours of Raw to fill, you can't fill it with shit. Well, they do fill it with shit, but I guess in their mind, you know, you've got to put some pay-per-view matches on there. But anyway, that trend started with WCW back in the mid-90s. 14 years ago this week, on November 21st, 1999, WCW Mayhem was their new pay-per-view replacing World War III from Toronto, Canada. It saw the climax of a 32-man tournament to determine a new WCW World Heavyweight Champion. Why did they need to crown a new world champion? Well, the month before, at Halloween Havoc, Bill Goldberg won the world and U.S. titles, which included an impromptu match with him and Sting. Night after, on Nitro, it was announced that Goldberg, in fact, did not win the WCW title because the match with Sting was not sanctioned. Hence, the title was to be held in abeyance. That's not what they called it back then. I'm using that big new fancy word that WWE taught us last month. There were a lot of things that made no sense here. I mean, you know, tons of interference in almost every single match. I give Vince Russo credit for the success that he had in WWE. You know, he and Vince McMahon together, they made a good team. He made an effort, at least, to try to get undercard guys in programs and give them something to do. In WWE back then, during, you know, the late 90s, it seemed like every undercard guy had a storyline. Didn't matter how far down the card you were. But in WCW, Russo was just an abject failure. The stuff he did during this period was cringeworthy. Let us not forget those pay-per-view promos when Russo was feuding with Bill Goldberg, where the voiceover guy spoke openly of Goldberg not following the script. So around this time, there was a backstage segment on TV with the former American Males, Buff Bagwell and Scotty Riggs, where Riggs told Bagwell that he was going over in their match. Yes, they were discussing the finish of their match on television. And Bagwell was all upset that Riggs was going to go over on him. And so when they wrestled, they had Bagwell pin Riggs against the script. He had wrestlers openly talking about the writers on the air. He may have thought he was trying some revolutionary New Age shit, but all he did... Yeah, you know, WCW was already on its way down. It was already dying. What Russo did was basically pinch the IV bag, thereby speeding up its death. Anyway, most of these tournament matches were over in like 3 minutes or less. People lost twice. It was just a complete clusterfuck. The only good thing that came out of this was a really good Bret Hart versus Chris Benoit match in the finals, which also had a shit ton of interference, but they still had a good match. I think it'd be pretty hard for those two guys not to. 12 years ago this week, on November 18, 2001, the end of the Alliance. The end of the Invasion storyline that could have been so much better than it turned out. They should have been able to keep that thing going at least through WrestleMania the following year and just build to like a big supercard, us versus them, but it was not meant to be. I also love how the promotional poster for this epic winner-take-all pay-per-view featured Lita and Tori Wilson. Yep. The Dudleys beat the Hardy Boys to unify the WWE and WCW tag team titles. Edge beat Test to unify the U.S. and Intercontinental titles into one IC title. Test then went on to win an Immunity Battle Royal, giving him immunity from being fired by whoever controlled the company after the main event was over. And 3 years later, he was fired. And in the main event, Team WWF, captained by The Rock, defeated the Alliance, captained by Stone Cold Steve Austin, for control of the company. Turned out Kurt Angle, who had joined the Alliance a month earlier, was actually a mole for Vince McMahon, and he turned on Austin. He hit him with Austin's title belt. Rock gave him a rock bottom and got the pin. The very next night, on November 19th, 2001, Monday Night Raw brought us the debut of the Vince McMahon Kiss My Ass Club, a club that has boasted many members over the years, but this was the first literal manifestation of said ass-kissing. That honor belonging to former Commissioner William Regal, who put on some chapstick, puckered up, and planted one on the chairman's backside so that he could keep his job. He was the first. He would not be the last. Jerry the King Lawler made his return to the announce booth for the first time since February of that year when he walked out of the company in protest of them firing his wife, the cat, Miss Kitty. Of all the WrestleManias for Lawler to miss, he sure picked a really bad one to miss. He had been replaced by Paul Heyman, who, after seeing the writing on the wall and realizing ECW was dead, he made the jump to WWE without telling anybody. So imagine the surprise of many of those ECW guys who were still owed money by Heyman when they saw his face pop up on WWE television. On this show, they fired Heyman, who then lunged at Jim Ross, who then beat up Heyman, and they dragged him from the ring kicking and screaming, making way for Lawler to come back. Speaking of returns, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, made his return to WWE, his first appearance since losing that Loser Leaves Town match to Mr. Perfect. It was almost a decade earlier. I think he was like, was it like 9 years? And he did so to announce to the world and to Vince McMahon, post-ass-kissing, of course, that he and Vince were now partners. He said he had bought Shane and Stephanie's stock, which they had earlier sold to a consortium, or as Flair called it, a consortium, so they could become the owners of WCW and ECW. And this is one of the many reasons the invasion in 2001 failed, in my view. You have Ric Flair make his return to TV the night after you end the invasion. Amazing. Don't you think the invasion would have benefited by having some big names like Flair, like Goldberg, like Hogan, like Bischoff? All those guys they ended up bringing in anyway. Having them before you killed off the angle? I know some of those guys were probably happy just sitting on their ass at home collecting money on the remainder of their contracts. But believe me, if WWE wanted them badly enough, they could have bought them out, taken the financial hit, and made that money back fivefold if they would have given us a real invasion and not some lame faction made up of almost entirely mid-card guys. 6 years ago this week, on November 19th, 2007, Chris Jericho returned to WWE after a two-year hiatus, revealed as the man behind the Save Us 222 vignettes that were airing on TV for weeks. He came out to confront the WWE champion Randy Orton. It's nice to see some things never change. I thought the way they did this reveal was kind of dumb. They had this Olympic torch runner running through the streets for the entire show. Because, you see, Randy Orton said he had beaten Shawn Michaels, he had beaten Triple H, he had beaten John Cena. There was nobody left to beat. And so it was time for the torch to be passed to him. So they have this guy running with the torch for 2 hours until the final segment where he finally reaches the arena. Only to be clotheslined by Jericho, who has his back turned to the camera. They tried to recreate some of the magic of his debut in Chicago, but it didn't work. Jericho would challenge Orton for the title. He would not win. Instead, he transitioned pretty quickly into a feud with JBL. 3 years ago this week, on November 22nd, 2010, The Miz cashed in Money in the Bank on Raw to beat Randy Orton after Orton had just wrestled Wade Barrett in a rematch from Survivor Series the night before. This is amazing. So Orton was the WWE champion in 2007, around this time. He was the WWE champion in 2010, around this time. And here we are in 2013, and he's the WWE champion, again, around this time. God, they need new people on top. Anyway, Miz beat Orton. Here's a guy that they tried to make. See, that's the one thing about it. Like, I look back on that, and I can never buy The Miz as WWE champion, especially the way they booked him. They certainly didn't do him any favors. But I can honestly look back on that and say, The Miz is somebody who was never in the main event picture before. It was somebody different. So I actually can give them credit for that. I like that. I like that they tried something new. I mean, maybe Wade Barrett would have been somebody better to try it with, but they went with Miz. And as far as Miz's reign is concerned, look, I've said this before. He was a body in the main event of WrestleMania. Were it not for The Rock, okay, and the plans they had with him, there's no way The Miz would have been in the WrestleMania main event. It never would have been a straight match, just Cena-Miz. Like, they never would have done that. They could afford to put Miz in there because it didn't matter. The whole thing going into WrestleMania was Cena-Rock. Everybody knew that. So that certainly didn't do him any favors. But still, The Miz can say that he was in the WrestleMania main event. And I thought the video package they put together for him was actually very very badass. And maybe the highlight of Miz's reign, from my view, is the TLC match that he had on Raw with Jerry Lawler, who at the time was, you know, 50-something years old. Give credit to Lawler for going in there and having as good of a match as he did. I remember being very impressed by that match. And, you know, it takes two to tango. You know, Lawler did great in his role. Miz did great in his role. I thought they had a hell of a match. To the point where when they rematched them at the pay-per-view in February, I was actually hoping they would pull the trigger and put the title on Lawler. Temporarily. So, you know, probably have him lose it back the next night or something. They didn't do that. Although I remember hearing that it was being considered. They at least did think about possibly putting the championship on Jerry Lawler. I was digging what they were doing with those two guys back then. So for me, for the Miz's reign, that was probably the highlight for me. Aside from that, I think they rematched Orton and Miz at the Rumble. I don't remember that being a really good match. There's nothing else about the Miz's title reign that really stands out to me aside from that TLC match and what they did with him at WrestleMania. So was it a failure? I don't know. What was their goal? What was their goal in putting the title on Miz? If their goal was to get him over as a more credible heel, I don't really know that that was much of a success. If their goal was just to put the title on somebody new and just let them kind of occupy that spot and keep the belt warm so they could do whatever they're going to do with Cena Rock, then yeah, I mean, he served his purpose, but it's not like The Miz came out of it a bigger star. And you look at the way they booked him over the last couple of years, he's right back down to where he was before he ever won that title in the first place. If they want to rebuild him, they've got to build him back up from scratch almost. So yeah, that was The Miz's reign 3 years ago. 2 years ago this week, on November 20th, 2011, Survivor Series at Madison Square Garden, my first one live. I was there. This show featured The Rock's first match since WrestleMania 20 in the same building. John Morrison's final WWE match against Dolph Ziggler for the U.S. title. I remember being in the building that night, and the people badly, desperately wanted Zack Ryder to somehow come out and, you know, get put in a championship match. We kept thinking there was some way they were going to work it where Ziggler could win his match, but then Ryder would come out and, you know, beg for a title shot, and he would get it, and he would win, and it would be this great big celebration in Madison Square Garden. And it didn't work out that way. But they did send Zack Ryder out to attack Ziggler when the match was over. But everybody, I mean everybody, was scratching their heads thinking the same thing. Why didn't they just book a match with Ziggler and with Ryder? Especially since Morrison was on his way out of the company. He was leaving. And you knew Ryder was going to be over in New York. The guy's from Long Island. That's what I'm talking about. You know, sometimes you got to give the people what they want. They ended up putting the title on Ryder the month after. It would have been so much better for them to just pull the trigger and do it at Survivor Series. People would have went nuts for that. But they didn't do it. Sin Cara injured himself about 5 minutes into his Survivor Series elimination match while running to do a dive out to the floor. And he was on the shelf for many months after that. So, standard Sin Cara match. Big Show performed a Randy Savage elbow off the top rope onto Mark Henry. Again, another case where you can make the argument that they should have pulled the trigger and had him win the world title. They should have just called an audible and had him pin Henry because, you know, if you weren't going to do the thing with Ryder, like maybe not do both of them, but people were really upset when Zack Ryder came out for a run-in and they realized, oh shit, that's it. So call an audible in that match. People were going nuts when Big Show came off the top for that elbow. Instead, what they did was they went with the cheap finish that just pissed everybody off, where Henry kicked Big Show in the balls and got DQ'd. That's never a good finish for any world championship match on pay-per-view. I'm sorry. And Henry ended up getting injured, and he dropped the belt a few weeks later anyway. CM Punk beat Alberto Del Rio to win the WWE title for a second time. That began his historic 434-day run as champion. And in the main event, The Rock teamed with John Cena to beat The Miz and R-Truth. Miz headlined WrestleMania and Survivor Series in the same year. I almost don't believe it. I mean, I know it really happened, but you look at where he is today, and it's just hard to comprehend. And finally, it was 1 year ago, on November 18, 2012, Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Roman Reigns made their debut on the main roster, interfering in the three-way main event at Survivor Series between John Cena, CM Punk, and Ryback, helping Punk retain the WWE Championship. And I cannot think of another trio of new guys, young guys, who have had the kind of year The Shield has. Through all the muck and all the aborted start-and-stop pushes and all the other guys that they've destroyed, I am amazed. I am continually amazed at the way that they've booked these three guys over the last year. It's been 12 months, and The Shield still feels special. You know, when The Shield's music hits and they come out of the crowd, their entrance, it's still a big deal. And they consistently have good matches with anybody you put them in the ring with. They go in there, they have kick-ass matches, they've been the MVPs of Raw for the entire year. I hope they never break up. I know they will, but that's how much I like the Shield. That's how big of a part of WWE over the last year they've been. WWE would have sucked without the Shield this year. Really, I mean, when you really look at it, it really would have. So they've had an amazing year, and it's been really cool to follow. You know, people, you know, Seth Rollins was down in developmental for a long time. Ambrose was down there for a while too. I wasn't watching, you know, FCW as it was back then before they changed it to NXT. But I know he was doing some stuff with William Regal that people were raving about. And you knew Ambrose and Rollins had the talent. Reigns I wasn't as familiar with. And I wasn't even convinced when he first debuted that he was, you know, he should have been with those guys. But I know why they did it, because you want to have the big, you know, the big muscle to back up the good wrestlers. And the thing that maybe surprises me the most is that Roman Reigns is a good wrestler. I don't see a problem with Roman Reigns at all. You know, maybe when they break him away from the Shield and he's doing singles matches, maybe he'll be exposed. Maybe he won't be as good. But I don't look at him as any sort of, you know, he's on the same level as those other two guys as far as I'm concerned. If anything, he's got a certain look and presence that the other two don't have. Ambrose is so weird. I mean, I can't compare anybody else to Dean Ambrose. Nobody from the current era I can really compare to Dean Ambrose. I mean, there's parts of Roddy Piper and Brian Pillman that I think are all mixed in there. Ambrose will be just fine. He's going to be a top heel. Rollins, I guess, of the three is the one I might worry the most about. I could see him kind of getting lost in the shuffle. I think him being a babyface makes more sense than a heel. But then again, you know, he bumps around like a madman, and that tends to work better when you're a heel. So hopefully all three guys, once they split, will end up being big stars. I think they're great, and it's been fun watching their progression over the last 12 months. And that's it. That's This Week in Wrestling History. I'm going to wrap this up right now. You can email your questions for the mailbag to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Audio questions, text questions, just send them all there. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I live blog during all the main shows. I'll be at the Nassau Coliseum for Raw this Monday night, so I'll be live tweeting from the arena, so you can follow me there. Facebook.com, we're all over Facebook. We have a profile page, fan page that you could like. And we have a discussion forum. We just passed 700 members. I think we're already up to like 715 or something like that. So if you want to be part of the 700 club, you got to find us on Facebook. Type in the full name of the show. It's a closed group. Apply for membership. You'll find the profile there and all that stuff. We have a good community of people there, so hopefully you can join us. And subscribe to us on YouTube, our official channel. My username on there is TheSolemonster, all one word. You'll find a whole bunch of reviews up there. I have an idea for a new feature that I might be starting very soon. I won't be doing a Survivor Series YouTube review this week, as I did for the last couple of pay-per-views. I'm just letting everybody know that now, so please don't ask me for it. But there will be new stuff going up there soon, so subscribe to us on there. We're now well over 5,000. Hopefully you are among them. And that's all the key stuff. You can stream us on Stitcher Radio. Help us climb the sports rankings. Last I checked, we were number 12 out of at least 100. In the top 100, we were number 12. I don't know how many sports shows. There's probably thousands of sports shows on there. So that's pretty cool. So help us climb the charts on there. Make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com if you want to see this show go another 300 episodes. It's the only way it's going to happen. We need your support. So please consider donating on thesolemonster.com. We'll be back next weekend with episode 303. Until then, be well, stay safe. If you are one of the few actually purchasing Survivor Series tonight, I certainly hope you get your money's worth. We're 2 hours and 12 minutes into this show. I'm done. Adios.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
If you don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a freak with Ace's name. I gotta get rid of this mess. I gotta get rid of this club. This club sucks.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Solomonster Sounds Off.